now present George Edwards in Frankenstein. Baron Frankenstein had taken refuge on the ship Voyager, which was icebound somewhere near the North Pole. The Baron was weak and ill, and the captain and his officers did their best to restore him to health. Gradually, he told them his story, and he explained to the captain of the attempts he made to create a man.
Do you feel able to tell me any more of your story now, Baron Frankenstein?
Somewhere out in those white wastes, there is something which must be destroyed. The thought of it is driving me mad. If only I could regain my strength. If only I could continue my quest.
Please do not distress yourself. The surgeon tells me that you are making an excellent recovery. I want to hear about your great experiment.
Well, I told you how my fiancée, Elizabeth, and my friend Ernst Claval and myself waited in the laboratory during the violent thunderstorm, while up above us, exposed to the full fury of the storm, lay the lifeless body which I had made. For a full hour, we watched, and everyone seemed to be agitated. My servant Julio crouched in a corner, and ever and anon cast fearful glances up above. At last, the hour passed, and I motioned to Julio to move over towards the pulley. Ernst and Elizabeth followed me, and I said, "Come, Julio. The body has been there for a full hour now. It is time to lower it." My hands are trembling with excitement, for soon I shall know whether I have created a man.
Stop! I make one more appeal to you, Victor. Do not proceed with that experiment. When you bring that body down, I beg you to destroy it.
After experimenting on it for months and months? Oh, what you ask is too much.
I also have my pleas to those of Elizabeth.
Well, I must turn a deaf ear to your pleas. Help me with this pulley, Julio.
I will, my master, but I am afraid the devil stalks abroad tonight.
Ah, that is nonsense. I am a scientist. I am conducting an experiment. Now lower it gently.
The storm seems to have abated a little.
I seldom remember a worse storm. The thunder is still pealing. It is a fitting night for devil's work.
This is not devil's work, Ernst. It is an achievement in the field of science. Now, roll the body off the lift.
Come on. Gently, Julio.
Over here. Faster. Close, all of you.
What are you going to do?
I am going to unwrap the bandages. We'll start here.
Nothing will happen. Nothing can happen. Oh, I feel that I must pray. Please do not let this creature have life.
We should all pray. It is not too late to stay your hand, Victor.
Right. I feel sure that I am on the verge of success. I am removing the wrappings now.
Why?
Look! The storm is increasing again. It sounds almost as if the voice of the heavens is protesting.
Look at the face. It is horrible.
I did not mean the face to be like that. I thought it would be beautiful. The skin is all drawn tight. It is awful. Oh, this is ghastly.
There is no sign of life.
Wait. I will remove the other bandages.
I have never seen such a hideous, bestial face. No creature like that could have life.
Elizabeth, what ails you?
Darn it. I swear, I saw them flutter.
The eyelids did move.
No, no. We must be dreaming. The horrible creature is looking at us.
No. It has closed its eyes again.
Julio, darken the room. The light is too strong.
My master, let me take this hammer. Let me destroy the creature.
You heard my orders. Lower the light.
I will obey.
Look. It is raising one arm.
It has life. My experiment has succeeded. I have created life. I am the greatest man the world has ever known. No other man has had such power. Victor, this is too horrible. Destroy it now.
Destroy it now would be murder.
Although this creature is terrible to look upon, it is a man. It has life. It has feelings just as you and I.
Can it speak?
Not yet. It must learn to speak. Just we have to learn.
That awful noise.
What are you going to do, Victor?
I was prepared for the success of this experiment. So there is a room all in readiness for my creation. Unlock the door of that room, Giulio.
I am afraid to destroy this creature.
Come, Giulio. You help me to create this man.
It is not a man. It is a monster.
It is moving. It is struggling into a sitting position. Have you unlocked the door of the room, Giulio?
I have, my master.
Then help me. We will move the creature into its abode. We will lock it in there. It will be your charge until tomorrow, Giulio. Remain here in the laboratory. Remain just outside the door. Do not enter the room yourself, and do not let anyone else enter.
I will obey.
Oh, this is my creation, a man which I made with my own hands.
The creature seems to be able to focus its eyes now. It is looking straight at me. Oh, it looks awful.
I shall train it myself. Come, take the other arm, Ernst. Let us lift it to walk across the room.
No, I cannot touch it. There is much I would do for you, Victor, but I cannot touch that monster.
I feel that I am going mad.
There is no need to be afraid. The creature is helpless. I can barely walk. You help me, Julio. Take the other arm.
No, do not make me touch it.
Do as I say. Look, I have taken one arm. Now, help it off the bench. Take it across the room. Carefully. It can barely drag one leg after the other.
I have never seen anything so horrible.
I admit I am disappointed in the appearance of my creation. It seems that in gaining life, the skin has become stretched tight, and the features have coarsened. Still, the creature has life, and that is the main thing. Now we will place him in this room. Careful, Giulio. Now, help. Help me get it off the bed.
Its head is not big enough. The creature seems to have become taller and bigger.
That is the extraordinary thing. Probably caused by the electricity.
Leave it on the bed. Now come outside. I'll lock the door. You take the key and keep it, Giulio.
I am glad the door is locked. I feel safer now.
I feel a strange and almost overpowering sense of triumph. In my wildest dream, I had not hoped for success. And I...
Victor!
He has fainted. No. I feel strangely weak. Help me to get out of here. Let me go to my room.
Baron Frankenstein, your story seems extraordinary. What became of the dreadful monster which you created?
I felt weak and ill that night, and Elizabeth and Ernst helped me to my room. There, I fell into a deep and troubled slumber. I awakened in the morning to find both Ernst and Elizabeth standing by the side of my bed. As soon as I sought them... Ernst? Elizabeth, what are you doing here?
We were worried about you.
Oh, I remember now. My great experiment was a success. I must go to the laboratory at once.
Victor, I beg you to destroy that creature. Just as you gave it life, so you can take that life away. I know that you will never be happy while the creature lives, and I know that I can never be happy. For the sake of the love you bear me, for the sake of the happiness which we desire, I beg you to destroy the creature.
Elizabeth is right, Victor. Your experiment was not altogether a success. You hoped to make something beautiful, and the result has been a hideous monster, a monster which you cannot unleash upon the world, or it will be forever upon your conscience.
Perhaps you are right.
I know we are right. Please, Victor, if you love me, you will do what I ask.
Well, I will dress at once, and then I will go over to the laboratory and make arrangements to do away with the monster. You shall come with me.
I will not go.
I will go with you, Victor.
Good.
Then if you wait for me downstairs, I will join you.
It seems that you regretted your somewhat rash experiment, Baron Frankenstein.
I did, Captain Wharton. And I feel happier when I had made up my mind to destroy my creation. I dressed hastily and went downstairs, where I found Ernst waiting for me. We walked across to the laboratory and entered the room, and then I called for Julio. Julio! Julio!
It is strange that he does not answer.
I ordered him not to leave here. Look, the door of the room where you put the creature. There is no door there. It is wrenched off its hinges.
What could have happened?
Look there in the corner. What is it?
Let me see.
What? It is the broken body of Julio.
The broken body of Julio?
Yes, look for yourself. Oh,
this is horrible. Let me look in that room.
Is there anyone there?
Why, the room is empty.
I am too late. The monster has escaped, and in so doing, he has murdered my servant. I have unleashed a horror.
The partner will...
I can speak no more of the matter at present, Captain Wharton. The memory of that horror is still too vivid.
I beg of you, let me rest.
Oh, I will let you rest, Baron Frankenstein.
I feel that I have not the right to sleep. I should not rest. But I must regain my strength.
Try and sleep now. I will send the ship's surgeon to you. And tomorrow I will come and speak with you again.
Present George Edwards in Frankenstein. Baron Victor Frankenstein is relating his tragic story to Captain Wharton of the good ship Voyager. The vessel is icebound somewhere near the North Pole. Frankenstein is taking shelter there. He told the captain of the creation of the monster and of events leading up to the monster's escape and the murder of Julio.
You look much better this morning, Baron Frankenstein. I trust you had a good night's sleep.
I feel better, thank you, Captain.
Tell me, what happened after you discovered the body of your servant Julio?
I recall it quite clearly. My friend Ernst Claval and myself were in the laboratory. We found that the door of the monster's room had been burst open, and there was the broken body of Julio lying upon the floor. We bent over the body and then Claval.
Do you realize, Victor, that you have unleashed a monster upon the world, a killer? Anybody's life may be in danger.
We must make a search immediately. I will organize a search party. All the peasants on the estate can join in the search. I now realize the enormity of my crime.
I will aid you, but I do not know what Elizabeth will say when she learns of this.
What are the authorities going to say? How am I going to explain the broken body of Julio?
You will have to tell the truth to the police.
But they will not believe me. They think I am mad.
Oh, you were mad to attempt this experiment. I am only sorry that it has succeeded. Elizabeth will be appalled when she hears this news.
I will search for the monster, I promise you. But I do not think there is anything further to fear, Ernst. The monster will perish. I wish that this were only a dream, some horrible nightmare, and I could awaken to find it was not true.
Lord Julio's body proves the truth of what has happened.
I know. But somehow my fear has vanished. I am going to seek my own happiness now.
Oh, how can you talk like that when the monster is alive?
The monster will be found. If not, he will perish. Let us go for the sea.
Tell me, Did the police succeed in finding the monster, Baron Frankenstein?
They did not. The search went on for days, and still there was no trace of the monster. But my hopes were high. I felt sure that the creature had wandered away somewhere in the hills, and there perished from cold and starvation. There came a day when I had almost forgotten the monster and my experiments. They seemed like some dim dream of the past. I sought out Elizabeth. Elizabeth, I feel sure that we will have no further fear of the strange creature for which I was responsible. I am asking you now, will you marry me and come away to England? Let us take a long journey together.
But, Victor, does your conscience allow you to leave here? Are you sure that nothing further will be heard of this horrible creature?
Oh, it is some months since the monster disappeared and nothing has been heard of it. It is safe for me to go now, Elizabeth.
How long shall we be away?
For at least 6 months. Then we shall return here and settle down in my home. Oh, please say that you will marry me as soon as possible, Elizabeth.
There is only one request I have to make of you, Victor.
What is it?
My sister's child, William, needs a home. His mother is very ill. His father is dead. Can he come and live with us?
Well, of course. I am very fond of William. We shall adopt him, and he shall be as our own child.
Oh, you are very kind, Victor.
Oh, I am just a man in love with a beautiful woman. Now, let us go and tell your father. We will be married very soon, and we shall make all arrangements for our journey.
Well, Baron Frankenstein, I trust you are not too tired to continue with the story?
No, I am just marshaling the facts recalling my happy marriage, those glorious few months in England, and then my return home.
How long did you remain in England?
For 8 months. We had a delightful holiday there, and I returned to my ancestral home, and my wife and I settled down. During our absence, we had left the child, William, in charge of a nurse, whom we called Justine. She was an old friend of the family. She had known my wife for years. A few days after our return, Justine approached my wife.
Master William desires that I shall take him out for a walk. Do you think the weather is clear enough, Baroness?
Oh, I think the child could go for a walk. What do you think, Victor?
By all means, the sun is shining brightly now, although there are clouds on the horizon.
Clouds on the horizon? Thick, black clouds. I fear there may be a storm.
Just such a storm as one...
Please, Victor, we agreed never to talk of that.
Well, may I take the child for a walk?
Yes, just a short walk down to the lake, Justine.
Tell me, Justine, do you like the child? Do you think that young Master William shows promise?
He is rather a David child, with a very strong will of his own. But I am fairly strict with him.
Oh, you must not be too strict with him. Remember, we were all young once.
I will remember that, Baroness.
All right, take him out now. But do not take him any further down the lake. If there are any signs of an approaching storm, bring William home at once.
I will, madame.
Tell me, Elizabeth, what do you think of Justine?
Oh, I have known her for years, my dear. But you do not seem to like her.
She is rather a grim and forbidding woman.
Oh, in reality, she has a very kind heart.
Come over here, Elizabeth. Look out of the window.
What is the matter?
Look at those strange black clouds on the far horizon. They fill me with a sense of grim foreboding.
Victor!
Clouds gathered like dust on the day that I created the monster.
Victor, do not think about it. The monster is dead. It is 12 months since he disappeared.
But is he dead? The body has never been found.
Darling, do you not think we would have heard if the monster had still been alive?
I suppose so. Did you hear that?
Thunder in the distance. Oh, I hope Justine has the intelligence to bring William home before the storm shows signs of breaking.
Why am I seized by this nameless fear? That thunder frightened me.
Darling, do not think of the past. Let us talk of something else. We know that your friend Ernst is due tomorrow. We hope he stays with us for some weeks.
I will be glad to see Ernst again, but in a way he will remind me of the horrors of the past.
Oh, you must do your best to forget. You must try and forget that the monster ever existed.
I must tell myself that. I created the monster, and now that monster is dead. I will never see it again.
Victor. What can I hear?
That dreadful sound. Strange dragging footsteps.
The footsteps are approaching this door. Oh, Victor, I am frightened.
The footsteps have stopped.
Victor, what can it mean?
Look, Elizabeth. The door is opening slowly. So slowly.
Frankenstein, my master. We meet again.
The monster.
This cannot be. I told myself that the monster no longer exists.
It is many months since we have met, my master. And now all that you desire. I can walk. I can move freely. I can think. And I can speak.
Where have you been?
Living in the woods these many months. Watching other folk, learning to speak as they speak, and almost dying from intolerable loneliness. I come to make terms with you, my master.
Terms? What mean you by that?
Victor, he looks too horrible. That awful face. Those long, shambling legs. Tell me it is not true.
Calm yourself, please, Elizabeth.
I am an object of hatred and scorn and derision wherever I go. You did this, Frankenstein. You gave me life, but a life which is filled with misery. All men, all women turn from me. Why did you give me life so that I may suffer?
If I had a gun, I would put an end to the life which I gave you. I would destroy you.
I do not wish to die. I wish to live. I wish to be happy as other men are.
Why? What do you ask of me?
You made me. You gave life to me. Now make a mate for me. A woman who may share my life with me.
What you ask is impossible. It shall be my mission in life to destroy you. Did you not kill my servant?
That matters not. We will talk of this again. I have come to make a bargain with you. Give me a companion, someone to share my loneliness. Why should I not know happiness as others know it?
Victor, you must not grant his request.
Fear not, Elizabeth. I will never grant it.
So be it, Frankenstein. You and yours shall suffer for this.
What mean you by that?
I killed one man, and I can kill others. And unless you heed my demand, unless you fashion for me a mate, then you and all your family will suffer. I will kill them just as I kill that man. I will kill all who stand in my path. I will leave a trail of death and destruction wherever I go. But I will not kill you. You shall live on until I bend you to my will. The creature shall rule the master.
Foul monster. I shall kill you now.
That puny mannequin.
Victor, be careful.
He is not dead. He laid his hands on me, and I hurled him away. Rise to your feet, Frankenstein.
I am powerless to destroy the thing which I created.
You are powerless. We shall meet again. You have refused my demand, but you shall hear from me. Farewell.
Victor, do not go after him. He will kill you.
Elizabeth, what can I do? You heard his threat.
Let us gather the villagers together so that by uniting we may destroy him. One man cannot prevail against him, but many will succeed in killing him.
You are right, Elizabeth. I swear that the monster of my creation shall die tonight.
Did you succeed in finding the monster that night, Baron Frankenstein?
Ask me no more now, Captain Walton. I am tired. I must not overtax my strength. Let me rest now.
You will rest now, and I will write the notes of your story in my journal.
So be it. Come to me tomorrow, and I will tell you of the horrors which befell me.
time now for Rocky Jordan. Not far from the Mosque Sultan Hassan in Cairo stands the Cafe Tambourine, run by Rocky Jordan. The Cafe Tambourine, crowded with forgotten men, alive with the babble of many languages. For this is Cairo, where modern adventure and intrigue unfold against a backdrop of antiquity. Tonight's story, My Quiet Friend.
Things had been rather peaceful around the cafe for the past few days. I was facing the prospect of another dull evening when the door to my office opened and two well-dressed guys eased in. Both of them were tall and on the rugged side. They were dressed in identical tan gabardine suits and white Panama hats. There was only one difference in their attire. One of them wore a bow tie, the other a four-in hand tied correctly with a Windsor knot, nestling perfectly in the center of the spread collar of his soft white shirt. He was the one who broke the silence.
You're Jordan, aren't you?
Yeah, but I'm not in the market for entertainers, especially a brother act.
You're wrong on both counts, wise guy. We just dropped in to sell you something.
Sorry, I got all the shoelaces I can use.
Pretty funny guy, ain't he, Maxie?
Yeah. Your friend's not much of a talker, is he?
Only when he has something important to say. My name's Moran, Leo Moran. Jordan, my quiet friend here is Maxie Schultz.
Maxie Schultz? Sounds familiar. You two boys from New York?
Yeah, but we're operating a little real estate service in Cairo now. Personalized service.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about it. On a clear day, you can hear the screams a mile away.
Well, that makes it easy, then.
It depends on what you mean by easy.
We have a client who's interested in your place.
It's not for sale.
We thought you'd say that, so we figured we could sell you on the idea of changing your mind. How about that, Maxie?
Yeah. I thought you only spoke when you had something important to say, Maxie.
Better take it on the slow bell, Speedy. I do other things.
Yeah, I'll bet. Where do you keep your ventriloquist?
Jordan, for your information, you're bandying words with Maxie the mechanic, expert in death traps.
And your customers never complain, do they, Maxie?
They ain't ever in shape to complain.
Now, about this client of ours, Jordan.
You're wasting your time, boys. Beat it. The joint's not for sale.
Our client will give you $500 cash for your cafe.
$500, huh? That wouldn't buy the furniture in this office.
You hear that, Maxie?
Yeah. Yeah, shame he feels that way, ain't it?
Now, take this little private bar of yours here, Jordan. I don't think it's worth much. And these crepes aren't bad, but they don't go well with the rest of the stuff. You like this mirror over here, Maxie?
Uh-uh.
Boy, you dirty...
I want you, Speedy. Nah, I sit still like a good little boy.
Maybe you shouldn't have hit Mr. Jordan so hard with that sap, Maxie. You might mess up that pretty face.
Oh, yeah, that'd be a shame.
Come on, Maxie. We'll see you later, Jordan. Maybe you'll have changed your mind by then.
I shook my head a few times, but the haze wouldn't clear, and the range was off. A tap on the side of the head hadn't helped my eyesight any. I remember seeing the gabardine boys leave. It was like looking through the wrong end of a pair of field glasses. And the room started spinning, and the lights went out. When I came out of it, the phone was ringing.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah, who is it?
Jordan, it's Charlie LeBouc.
LeBouc? What do you want?
Look, Jordan, I think it's about time the two of us forget our little differences and have a nice friendly talk, huh?
Why should we?
I don't like it any more than you, Jordan, but it'll be the smart thing to do. It's about this mob that's taking over.
Keep talking.
Well, you and I are just about the only two cafe operators who haven't sold out. If we stay together, maybe we can beat them all. They've looked over this situation pretty well, Jordan. They won't expect us to team up on them.
All right. What's the spread?
Come over to my place, Jordan. I have a man here who can do us some good.
I like names, LeBouc.
It's Nick Spalvo. How about it?
Nick Spalvo, huh? Okay, give me half an hour. Nick Spalvo had owned the Blue Palm Cafe up to a couple of weeks ago. Then, like half a dozen other gin hall merchants, he'd fallen in line with the mob and had moved out without a murmur to the law. Now it looked like Nick had changed his mind. I went out front, hopped a cab, and shortly after 7:30, I piled out in front of Charlie LeBouc's cafe. I pushed my way through the crowd and went up the stairs. At the end of a small, narrow corridor was a door marked private. It was half open. I pushed it the rest of the way. The first thing that caught my eye was the open window and the wind whipping the curtains into the room. Then I saw LeBouc sprawled out on the soft green carpet behind his desk. There were half a dozen bruises on the side of his face and a dark purple crease over the bridge of his nose. LeBouc's company had played a little too hard, and with his weak pump, LeBouc couldn't keep up acting host. He was dead. Then I remembered Nick Spalvo. I went into the room next to the office, but he wasn't around. I started out into the corridor again when I heard voices, and the cigarette girl eased around the corner. Behind her was one of LeBouc's boys with his right hand in his tux pocket. I ducked back into the office and through the open window to the fire escape. I didn't have time to stick around for explanations. Maybe LeBouc's boy wouldn't give me the chance. I had just dropped to the sidewalk when... And then LeBouc's boy suddenly showed up in the window. I was glad then that I hadn't waited. At the corner, I grabbed a hack, and 15 minutes later, I was leaning on the buzzer of apartment 21 at the Sherita house.
Yes, what... Oh, Rocky.
Hello, Nina.
Well, this is a surprise.
I wasn't sure if I'd catch you in.
I don't go to the club till 9. You know that, darling. Come here. Come here.
You were still dancing at the Blue Palm, huh?
Mm, of course, darling. Sit down. Can I fix your drink?
I thought maybe after Nick Spalvo sold out, you might have left the club.
Why should I? Oh, I like Nick a lot, but then a girl has to make a living.
How do you get along with the new boss?
I've only seen him once or twice. He doesn't come to the club much. Now, about that drink, Rocky.
Where's Nick, do you know?
Rocky, must you always talk about business?
Nick, baby, where is he?
I don't know, Rocky. At his apartment, I suppose. Why?
I went around to check before I dropped into Charlie LeBouc's club. Three of us were supposed to meet there.
Charlie LeBouc?
When I got there, LeBouc was dead. Nick wasn't around.
Dead? Oh, Rocky.
No, relax. I didn't do it. In a room next to LeBouc's office, there was a cot and a few blankets and an ashtray full of cigar butts. They might have been Nick's.
Rocky, I don't understand. What does it all mean? It
means that Nick could have been hiding out at LeBouc's.
But why?
Look, baby, Nick didn't want to sell his place. The other owners didn't want to either. But they were pressured into it by a couple of strong-arm boys and told to keep quiet about it.
So that's it. I thought it was strange.
Nick couldn't take it. He decided to talk, so he waltzed over to LeBouc's and told him about it. LeBouc had been given the same pitch, and he wasn't happy about it either, so he called me and suggested we get together and fight off the wolves.
That's why you went to Charlie's place.
Yeah, but the pressure boys beat me to it. I don't think they wanted to kill LeBouc. They just played a little too rough.
But Nick, where's he?
Nick might have been in the room next door when LeBouc was killed. He probably ducked out.
Did you ask anyone at the club if Nick had been there?
I didn't have time. I had to leave rather suddenly. One of LeBouc's boys kind of got ideas that I'd bumped off his boss.
Oh, Rocky, the police, they'll think that you... Rocky, you've got to get away. I'll help you.
Oh, thanks, baby, but...
Please, Rocky.
I've got to find Nick.
But with the police looking for you and LeBouc's men, you won't have a chance, Rocky.
Well, it'll take a bit of doing. And that's where you come in.
Of course, anything you say, but I...
Where would Nick go? Any ideas?
Well, I... Let me think.
Girlfriends, relatives?
Celeste Donati... But she's in Port Said for a few weeks.
Okay, where's her place?
At the Komar Apartments on Shari Amun.
Where else would Nick hide out?
Well, he has so many relatives. Perhaps his cousin's shop in the square. Or his uncle's house. Wait, there's a brother, too.
Hey, slow down, baby. I'll need some names and addresses first. Then I'm going to go call him. Fifteen minutes later, I grabbed a cab in front of Nina's place, and shortly before 8:30, I pulled up in front of a small tobacco shop near the old Helwan station. A single light burned in the back of the shop, and beneath it sat a fat-faced Turk, dozing quietly, his feet propped up on the low counter. I went inside. All right, George, snap out of it. You got a customer. Come on, wake up. The Turk hadn't been asleep. He'd been out cold. And when I shook him, he rolled off the chair and dropped to the floor. I noticed a dark purple bruise over the bridge of his nose. The same mark I'd seen earlier on Charlie LeBouc. I worked on him a few minutes, and then he snapped out of it.
No. No, please.
All right, take it easy, Chum. I'm not going to hurt you.
Here, I'll help you up. My head.
You're a couple of boys who dress alike, huh?
Yes. Yes, they wanted to know where Nick... Who are you?
The name's Jordan. I'm a friend of Nick's.
Oh, yes, I have heard of you.
Was Nick here tonight?
Not more than 10 minutes ago. These two men came after him, but Nick saw them and went out the back way.
And he must have tailed him here from LaBook's.
Mr. Jordan, what has happened? Is Nick in trouble?
Yeah, he witnessed a murder. Charlie LaBook's. Those two boys who worked you over did it. Any idea where Nick went to?
No. He had just come in. We were in the back of the shop. He started to tell me what had happened when the two men walked in. Nick went out the back way.
How about Nick's brother? He lives around here. Think he could have gone there?
Perhaps. I do not know.
How much did you tell the boys who worked you over?
Nothing. Nothing at all. I could not tell them where Nick went because I do not know.
Okay. I'm going around to see Nick's brother. You better fix your face up and close up shop. Those two boys are liable to come back for more. And I don't mean cigarettes. Nick's brother lived in a narrow side street about 3 blocks away. When I got there, the house was dark. The only answer to my knock on the heavy door was a dog howl coming from somewhere inside. I waited for a minute and went back downstairs and started for the rear of the house. I caught a movement along the wall out of the corner of my eye, but I just kept walking. I went around the side of the house and pulled into a doorway. A few seconds later, I heard him coming along the gravel walk. When he passed me, I reached out. His gun came up, but he didn't have the chance to use it. I flipped on my cigarette light and held it to his face. It was Charlie LaBook's boy, the guy who'd taken the pot shots at me from the window. He was still red hot in the idea that I'd bumped off his boss. I packed him off to my cab, gave the driver an address, and we took off. I had to put this boy on ice before somebody got hurt. Couldn't expect my luck to hold out all night. Well, 10 minutes later, I walked into Madame Farid's little establishment down on the waterfront. For a little silver across the pond, the old girl was always more than happy to kick your fortune around in a teacup or even consult the crystal ball.
Oh, Rocky, Rocky Jordan. It is a long time I have not seen you. Come in, come in.
Hi, Grandma. Well, how's the future look?
You wish to consult Madame Farid?
Yeah, I've got a problem. There happens to be a short, dark, and ugly character following me with murder on his mind.
Sure.
He's got the picture all wrong, but I don't have the time to explain it to him now. He's sleeping off our last engagement in my cab outside.
I see. Oh, it is a problem, Rocky.
Yeah, take a look at my palm, sweetheart. Oh, you'll find it just under this $10 bill.
Yes, I see. Well, I would say there is an old woman who can help you. I can see an empty cellar, an excellent place to put this man till morning, perhaps, until you can explain his mistake.
That's the best advice I've had all day. It's a deal. Now, where can I find this old woman who's going to help me?
Bring him in, Rocky. Bring him in.
At least with LaBook's boy out of the way, I wouldn't have to worry about his taking a pot shot at me every time I turned around. I still had to find Nick before the Gabardine boys did. And my next stop was Celeste Donati's place at the Comar Hotel Apartments in the Sharia El Mun. Even if Nick's doll wasn't around, he might be using the place as a hideout, and it was worth a try. I was just about to press the buzzer over the nameplate when the door opened suddenly. Framed there was Captain Sam Sabaya, Cairo Police.
Hello, Jordan.
Uh-oh. Hello, Sam.
I've been looking for you. Come on in.
Sure. What are you doing here, Sam, if you were looking for me?
I'm also looking for Nick Sparrow.
Well, so is everybody else.
What happened to Charlie LaBook, Jordan?
I'm not sure, Sam. I arrived a little late.
I got there even later. All I found was LeBouc dead. You and Nick had already left. Why?
Nick left because LeBouc's killers got too close to him. I left because one of LeBouc's boys got an idea I'd polished off his boss.
What were you doing at LeBouc's? I have heard you were not very good friends, Jordan.
Oh, just small talk.
Jordan, I have
all no... All right, all right. He called me over to team up with him against the pressure boys who were buying up a flock of joints.
Or didn't you know about that?
We know all about it, Joe.
Then why haven't you done something?
We have nothing to go on. Absolutely nothing. The cafe owners have refused to talk.
Nick changed his mind. He'll sing like a blue jay.
Is that why he was at LeBouc's?
Yeah. He knows who bumped off LeBouc.
Do you?
The Gabardine boys, Sam. It figures.
The Gabardine?
Leo Moran and Maxie Schultz. The super salesman.
Oh. Succomelli's men.
What?
Frank Succomelli. He's behind this scheme, Jordan.
How'd he get here? Thought after they'd booted him out of the States back to his own country.
It is all very legal, Jordan. As long as he stays out of trouble, there is nothing we can do. But he'll slip up here in Cairo just as he did back in the States.
He already has, Sam. I think you can make it pretty hot for Succomelli once you find Nick Spalvo.
Well, Jordan, for your sake, I hope we find him alive.
Don't you like my story, Sam?
Oh, I do. But I am only a captain of police. There are others who may not like it. After all, no one else saw Moran and Schultz at LeBouc's.
Which makes me number one boy, because LeBouc and I never get along too well. Sure, sure, Sam. So instead of standing here around here yapping, why don't you go out and find Nick?
I intend to.
All right. Where do we go now?
I'm going to drive you back to the Tambourine, Jordan.
The Tambourine? Oh, now, wait a minute.
Yes, Sam. And you're going to stay there till this thing is cleared up.
Sorry, Sam. My foot's in the door. I want in.
This is a matter for the police, Jordan. You'd better stay out of it for your own good. You're not doing very well so far, you know.
All right, all right. Come on. Sam and I piled into the police crate and headed downtown. I didn't put up much of an argument about being herded back to my cafe, because it suddenly dawned on me that doing just that might have been the smart thing to do from the first. Nick must have known about my coming over to LeBouc's to talk about teaming up, and he'd probably make an effort to contact me. The Tambourine would be the first place he'd try. Sam and his boys dropped me off in front of the cafe, and I went in. I pushed through the crowd to the back and opened the office door.
Hello, Jordan. We've been waiting for you. Come on in. Close the door.
The Gabardine boys, Leo and Maxie, were standing in the center of the room. Leaning against my desk with a cigar stuck in the corner of his fat face was a short, heavy-set guy. He had a thick mop of black curly hair, eyes that hit you like a hot iron. In his hand was a fingernail file. When I walked in, he went back to work with it on his short, pudgy fingers. Then, without looking up...
Hello, Jordan.
What are you doing here, Succomelli?
Oh, you recognize me, huh?
No trouble at all. You used to be the favorite pinup boy of the post offices back in the States.
They were lousy photographs, Jordan.
Don't blame the camera, Succomelli. I've seen better heads than a pin.
There he goes again, Leo. I don't think...
All right, Maxie, that's enough. Let Mr. Jordan have his little joke. We have plenty of time.
Well, I haven't, Succomelli. I gotta get this place sprayed. You got no idea the stuff that crawls in here these days.
What do you think of the offer my boys made to you?
I haven't laughed so hard in years.
What's wrong with $500 for this dump?
You're in a weed field, Succomelli.
All right, Jordan. We can talk about that later. Right now, I'm interested in Spalvo.
Spalvo? What's that? Something you spread on bread?
Where is he, Jordan?
I wouldn't give you the right time, Succomelli.
Where is he hiding?
Get lost, punk. I'm busy.
All right, Maxie. Leo.
Okay, wise guy. This is as far as you go. Hold him, Leo.
Yeah, I got him.
Let him have it.
Now, Jordan, let's start from the beginning.
When the blackjack caught me on the side of the head, my knees started to give out, but Maxie got behind me and held me up. With one hand, he jerked my head back. Leo grabbed my shirt front, pulled the rod out of his pocket, and started tapping the bridge of my nose with a gun barrel. Then I remembered the bruise, that dark purple crease on LeBouc's nose and the Turk's. It was a nice, slow, and easy way of driving a guy off his rocker. The first few taps weren't bad. After that, you lost count. It was like a pile driver coming down on your head. The last thing I remembered was Succomelli. He was still leaning against the desk, working the file and blowing in his fingernails. And he was asking me about Nick somebody.
You are listening to My Quiet Friend, tonight's adventure with Rocky Jordan. Tomorrow night, radio's most popular dramatic program, CBS Radio Theater, brings you The Song of Bernadette. This inspiring screen story of a humble girl whose faith elevated her to sainthood will be the Easter week presentation of Radio Theater Monday night at 6. Ann Baxter and Charles Bickford are the stars. Don't miss it tomorrow, Monday night at 6 on CBS. Now, Now we return you to Cairo and tonight's adventure with Rocky Jordan, my quiet friend.
When a character named Frank Succomelli moved to take over the Cairo night spots, gangster style, a couple of gin mill owners and I decided to get together. But just before we kept our date, one of them was murdered. The other, named Nick Spalvo, disappeared. I spent a lot of time looking for Spalvo without any luck. When I got back to the Tambourine, Succomelli and his two boys were waiting for me and gave me a nice going over with a gun barrel. It was quite a bit later when I finally started to wake up.
Rocky. Rocky.
Oh, go away.
Rocky, it's Nina.
Nina. A great girl, fine dancer.
Rocky, listen to me, please.
Nina, one of the nicest... Wait a minute, what is this?
Not where... so loud, Rocky, they'll hear you.
Nina.
You're at the Blue Palm Cafe, Rocky. I saw them when they brought you in an hour ago.
Blue Palm?
Yes, one of the upstairs rooms.
Oh, yeah. Kind of comes back now. What happened to my playmates?
Leo and Maxie are out and back. They're loading up the owner's car.
Where's Succomelli?
Succomelli?
The boss.
Oh, in his office. Rocky, I think the three of them are getting ready to leave.
Not without me, they don't.
Oh, no, Rocky, they'll kill you. You've got to get away.
Not on your life. I have a score to settle with this crowd. Look, baby, it's a cinch they're not going to take off without making another try to find out where Nick is. I think I can stall them off long enough.
But why, Rocky? Why don't you leave when
can you
can?
Can you get to a phone and fast?
Yes.
Then hop to it, Nina. Give Captain Sabaya a buzz at police headquarters and unload the glad tidings. And tell him to hurry up and get here. Nina eased out the door, and I heard her high heels clicking off down the hall. I made my way across the darkened room to the window and looked down into the parking lot below. A long, gleaming limousine was parked in the driveway. Walking away from it were Leo and Maxie. Maxie was wiping his hands. They passed under my window and went into the cafe. I waited a couple of minutes, then I heard footsteps in the hall. The key turned in the lock.
Turn the light on, Maxie.
Yeah, sure.
Well, look at that, Maxie. Bright boy is up and around again.
Yeah.
How do you feel, Jordan?
It's fine, boys. We go around again?
You don't look so bad for a guy who's had a rough evening.
I'm used to it.
Well, the night isn't over yet. Come on, Succomelli wants to see you. And he doesn't like to be kept waiting.
You two really jump through the hoop for that punk, don't you?
I wouldn't say that, Jordan.
He orders you around like a couple of zombies.
We're not worried. Not a bit.
You do the dirty work and he rakes in the dough. What's the matter? You scared of the little bum?
Like Leo said, Jordan, we ain't worried. Not a bit, huh, Leo? Now, come on, let's go.
Yeah, what's your hurry?
Look, wise guy, do you want me to wrap this sap beside your head again?
Well, if you...
What's the matter? Ain't you ever seen a blackjack before?
Yeah, sure. Okay, boys, let's not keep Mr. Succomelli waiting, huh? We walked down the hall to Succomelli's office. He was sitting there at his desk, smiling like a pitcher who had just struck out murderer's role. He had his hat and coat on, and in front of him, resting in the green blotter, was a briefcase.
Ah, Jordan, I see you have recovered.
It's a special favor to you, Succomelli. That's as far as I go.
I've decided to forget about Nick. I'm afraid it's a little too late now to do anything about that.
You're going to pull out, huh?
Yeah. I've decided not to press my luck too far. We've made a neat little pile of dough anyway, haven't we, boys?
Yeah, let's get out of here. We can dump Jordan on the road.
Good idea, Leo. I'll take care of it.
Now, we can do it, Frank. Me and Leo take Jordan in our car and follow you.
No, I'll take care of it, Maxie. After I've taken care of something else first.
What do you mean?
This, Maxie.
Frank, no! Oh, you dirty... Max had started to get up out of the chair when the first slug hit him and he dropped back. Leo went down right at my feet. The Gabardine boys were through. Succomelli had just done a nice job of trimming the payroll.
All right, Jordan, let's go.
Oh, I don't get it here, huh?
No, I have other plans for you. I think I'll take you along with me. Until I get out of Cairo, anyway.
You won't, Succomelli.
Shut up. Get moving.
Okay. Succomelli prided me in the back with a snub-nosed revolver, and we walked down the back steps into the lot. We crossed the gravel driveway and headed for the long black limousine.
Straight ahead, Jordan. Don't get any ideas. I've handled guys like you before.
Yeah, I can believe that.
Go on.
Okay, you don't have to push that gun through my back. It's sore enough now.
You'll never know it in the morning. All right, Jordan, now open it.
What's the matter, Succomelli?
Open the door.
sure. Now back away. I'm getting in.
Oh, I'm not invited, huh?
Sorry. I'm taking off alone, Jordan. I changed my mind.
Hey, you'll have to step on it. Sam Sabai will be here in a minute.
I'm not worried, Jordan. I'll leave you here to meet him with a bullet in your head. When they stop to investigate your corpse, it will give me extra time.
You know, I just thought of something.
What's so funny?
This is going to be close. The law will be here in a minute. Suppose you can't start your car.
Don't worry about that, Jordan. It'll start.
Yeah? Why don't you press the starter button?
Okay, Jordan. Just so you won't die with it on your mind, watch.
I had a hunch what was coming. As soon as Succomelli's hand went for the starter button, I hit the ground, started to roll. But even so, I caught part of the blast. I was shaking the buzz out of my ears and scrambling to my feet when the police car screeched up to a stop.
Jordan! Jordan, are you alive?
Yeah. Yeah, you missed the big blow-up, Sam.
Moran and Schultz, where are they?
Oh, upstairs and out of this world. Succomelli had a surprise for him. He got in some target practice.
And Succomelli, is he...
Yeah, he's in there, in what's left of the car. But don't bother, Sam.
How did this happen?
Moran and Schultz had a little surprise for Succomelli, too. Maxie's favorite trick, a bomb. You press the starter button and... that's all, brother.
How did you miss this?
I was scheduled to go along, but Succomelli changed his mind. I was hoping he would.
You knew about the explosives?
I had a hunch from the way Leo and Maxie were talking that they were up to something. And when I spotted grease on Maxie's hand, I figured he'd been messing around with his hobby. Too bad he didn't live to see this. He'd have been proud of the job.
Rocky!
Oh, hi, Anita.
Oh, Rocky, are you all right?
Yeah, sure, I'll make it. Although my face could stand a job of patching up.
Well, I suggest you come with me to the emergency hospital and have...
Oh, skip it, Sam. It's not that bad.
Please, Rocky, you must have those bruises taken care of. Come on, I'll drive you home.
Home? Who wants to go back to the tambourine?
I didn't have that in mind, Rocky.
Oh. Well, see you later, Sam.
Hello?
This is Captain Sabaya. Is Jordan still there?
Yes. Just a moment, Captain. Rocky. Rocky.
Huh?
It's for you, Captain Sabaya.
Oh, thanks, Nina. Hello, Sam.
Jordan, I thought you'd like to know Nick Spalvo was waiting for us at headquarters when we got back.
Mm-hmm.
It was as you said, Jordan. Moran and Hume in the booth. He saw them do it. Well, Jordan, did you hear what I said?
Huh? Well, what was that, Sam?
To me.
Oh, it's a beautiful night, Sam. With a lady's cool hand on my fevered brow. I'll have to admit it's a little distracting. What was that again?
Nothing. Nothing at all. Good night.
What was that?
I said good night.
Oh, yeah. Good night, Sam.
CBS, again at this same time next week for another story of adventure and intrigue when we take you back to Cairo and the Cafe Tambourine run by Rocky Jordan. Jack Moyles plays the title role with tonight's story by John Moore. Rocky Jordan is produced and directed by Cliff Howell with original music by Richard Arant. Larry Thor speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Diamond Detective Agency. A pleasant smile, a cheerful rhyme, and we'll keep you from doing time.
Oh.
Hi, Alan.
Hi. Rick, where do you get that cheerful rhyme bit?
You didn't think so?
I didn't think so.
Killjoy.
Why can't you answer the phone like other people do? Just say hello.
You know, I never thought of that.
You should try it sometimes. Your prospective clients might think they were dealing with a sane, normal person.
You think it's fair to mislead them?
Oh, Rick. Are you busy?
Silly girl. Busy detectives make money. I just sit at my desk and make conversation with a beautiful redhead.
Well, why don't you leave your desk and come make conversation with said redhead in person?
That's not a bad idea.
I'm all alone.
The idea's getting better.
It's not even noon yet. We can go for a long walk.
Oh.
Well, you don't sound very enthusiastic. What's wrong with taking a walk?
Honey, in my business, I do more legwork than a pair of nylons. Walking just isn't my idea of a ripping good time.
Have you a better suggestion?
You can know me for 5 years and ask questions like that. Oh, now, dear, let's just... skip it. I am not alone.
Client?
Mm-mm. Shrimp Martin.
Well, I don't think I know him.
Well, that's something to be proud of. Call you later, dear. Bye.
Bye.
Hello, Diamond.
Never mind shaking hands, Shrimp. I want to keep my cufflinks.
You know me, Rick.
Too well. What brings you here, small man?
Strictly business.
Oh, come off it, Shrimp. You don't have enough to hire a bathtub, let alone a detective.
On the level, Rick, I'm here to make you some dough.
Just a big-hearted guy, huh? Okay, spell it.
You heard of Hank Burton?
I read the papers.
Then you read how Hank lifted 50 G's worth of rocks a few months back.
So?
So they're offering an even grand reward for whoever brings Hank in.
What are you getting at?
Just that... That even thousand is your fee if you'll do the little job.
What?
Now, Hank Burton, he's the one who sent me. He says he'll let you turn him in and collect the grand.
Well, another big-hearted guy. Make yourself clear, Shrimp, and fast.
Burton wants to see you. He wants you to do a legit job for him. He'll pay you for it by letting you turn him in.
Doesn't make sense.
Sure it does. Hank's a sick boy, bad heart condition. If he don't get some hospital care soon, he's a goner. Only as soon as he shows up at a hospital, the cops will nab him. So he might as well give himself up.
And he'll let me be the one to collect the reward for it, huh?
You got it right. That's his way of paying you for the job he wants done.
Just what's the job?
Sorry, I said as much as I know. Except the job is strictly on the up and up. The rest you can hear from Hank himself.
Where do I find it?
I take you to him if you're interested in taking the job.
Shrimp, I'm interested in almost anything that involves $1,000. Only if this deal isn't on the level, I'll ram those buck teeth of yours down your throat.
I tell the truth. I swear it.
Don't bother to cross your heart. I doubt you'd be able to find it. Let's go see Burton. I didn't have any faith in Shrimp Martin, but the thought of 1,000 green pieces of paper did wonders for my bankrupt morale. We took my car, and Shrimp directed me to the warehouse section on Front Street. We parked beside a deserted-looking warehouse, and Shrimp led me inside through a rear door.
He should be here by now. Hank!
Over here, Shrimp.
Behind those boxes over there, Diamond.
Well, I heard him.
Hello, Dad.
Hank, Shrimp tells me you have a deal to make.
Yes, sir. Shrimp, go outside so we ain't interrupted.
All right.
Sit on one of them boxes, Diamond. I got a lot to say.
I'll stand.
It's up to you.
You look bad, Hank.
Never mind. Did Shrimp explain the setup?
All except the job you expect in return for handing you over.
Okay. I want you to find a girl, Diamond. That's all.
That could be enough. Who's the girl?
Her name is Lee Thorpe. You find out where she's located now, and I'll let you turn me in.
Uh-huh. Why is it so important you know where this Lee Thorpe is, Hank?
Because if I have to take the rap on that jewelry heist, she takes it with me.
Keep talking.
I met her about 4 months ago. Felt pretty hard. She seemed to go for me, too. We made plans, big plans. And my ticket went bad. She suggested we go to Mexico where I could be taken care of, but that took dough.
So you pulled the jewelry store robbery?
Yeah. It was her idea. She said she knew of a fence where she could change the rocks in the door and we'd be out of country within a month.
But the deal fell through, huh?
Yeah. I was spotted during the job. I had to hide out, but I sent her the rocks. She said to give her a week.
I think I can guess what happened.
Ain't hard. When I contacted her a week later, I found out she moved, disappeared. What a sap I was. On a sap.
You were sapped to steal the stones in the first place, Hank.
Okay. Okay, no speeches. All I want you to do is locate this dam so the bulls can nab her, too.
Uh-huh. Well, why not go to the police right away, Hank? Tell them the story and let them pick her up.
No. No, she's smart. As soon as the word gets out of and picked up, she'll figure squealing. It'll be harder to find it.
Mm-hmm. Won't be so easy now. Any idea where she might be?
If I knew, I'd find her myself. You're the gumshoe, get to work. $1,000 ain't bad pay, you know.
No, no, it's not bad at all. Only how do I know you'll keep the bargain?
Look at me, will you? I'm a dying man unless I get help. Don't worry, I'll let you turn me in. After you find the girl.
All right, Burton, I'll take a chance. Where do I get in touch with you?
You know, I'll call you at your office around 6. Work fast, huh, Diamond? Find her as soon as you can.
Yeah, Hank. As soon as I can. Hank Burton was in a bad way. And if he wouldn't give himself up until Lee Thorpe was located, then it was true she'd have to be found quickly. Hank didn't have much time left. We left the warehouse together. He and Shrimp Martin disappeared down Front Street, and I drove back uptown. At the 5th Precinct, I found that Lieutenant Walt Levinson was out to lunch. But in the meantime, the sergeant let me look through the files.
Well, make yourself right at home, Mr. Diamond.
Well, thank you, Lieutenant. I have.
It's a wonder you're not sitting behind my desk. I'm sure you'd be more comfortable.
Well, now, I might just take you up on that when I get tired.
Fine, fine. Maybe you'd even like one of my uniforms to wear.
Now, Walt, let's not carry the joke too far. When I was on the force, I tried to get into one of your uniforms. It looked like Bonnie Prince Charlie in a raccoon coat.
Just when I need after a nice lunch. You were around to give me indigestion.
What are you looking for, anyway? I found it. File on a girl named Lee Thorpe.
Thorpe. Yeah, I remember. I used to be married to Davy Thorpe.
Used to be?
Yeah, it's all there in the folder. She split up with Davy 2, maybe 3 years ago when he was sent up.
Davy still in prison?
Uh-uh. Out about a year ago. What do you want this Lee girl for?
Sorry, Walt. Confidential.
Oh, great. I ask a question, you tell me it's confidential, but you think you can walk in here and poke through our files all you please.
Cheer up, Fatty. I'll tell you all about it after I find Lee Thorpe.
Well, now, that's mighty big of you, Mr. Diamond.
Well, think nothing of it, Lieutenant.
I don't. Find anything in the folder?
Not much. She's been picked up on a few minor offenses, that's all. What about Davy, her ex-husband?
Oh, he seems pretty legitimate these days. Running a pool room over on 3rd. Listed in the book as Davy's Billiard Parlor.
That's an original name. Well, I guess I'll go see Davy. Maybe he's seen his ex-wife lately.
Oh, don't rush off, Bright Eyes. Things are so dull around here when you're not poking your nose into our business.
I know, but don't feel bad, Walt. He'll be back.
Well, goody gumdrop. I'll have our best cell waiting.
You're such a wonderful host. See you later, Walt. Davy's pool room turned out to be a dingy joint. There were no customers this early in the afternoon, but Davy must not have liked his tables to go to waste. He was playing at a front table all by himself. I walked over to him. Well, nice shot, Davy.
Huh? Oh, want a game, Mac?
I'd rather talk.
This is a pool room, not a conversation club.
It's about your wife, Davy.
I got no wife.
You did have.
I had measles once, too, but that don't mean I'm still scratching.
Have you seen Lee recently?
All depends on how recent you call recently.
Oh, in the last month or so?
Mm-mm. Seen her when I first got out, close to a year ago. She wants to pick up where we left off.
And?
I told her where to get off. You beat these dames. I get sent up out of circulation for a while. She wants to be free. Then I'm out, she wants to get all chummy again.
Well, maybe you know where she might hang around, Davy.
Yeah, maybe. You a cop?
Private. Well?
Well, what? I'm a businessman, pal. I don't shoot off my mouth out of fun of it.
Will $10 take the fun out of it?
You don't see me laughing, do you? Put the money on the table.
Okay, there you are.
Much obliged. Yeah, I might know where Lee hangs out. I'm not saying it for sure, mind you. Been almost a year since I've seen her.
Keep talking.
She always likes bars, lights, people. She used to drag me to a bar all the time.
Any particular bar?
Mm-hmm. The Bluebird Club over on 40th. In fact, that's where I first met her. Excuse me a sec. Hey, take a few shots while I answer that. Hello? Davies Billiard Parlor. Huh? Maybe yes. Hold it. Hey, Shamus. Your name Richard Diamond?
That's right.
That's for you. If you want more out of me, I'll be over in the office.
Thanks. Hello?
Oh, Rick. I took a chance. Figured you'd still be there.
What's up?
Funny, but right after you were here, we got a call about Lee Thorpe. Picked her up right away.
Good boy. I'll be right down. You at the precinct?
Uh-uh. I'm at the morgue.
What?
And don't bother to hurry, Rick. This girl won't be going anywhere. Not now.
Before we continue with Richard Diamond, here are a few words about smoking enjoyment. According to nationwide surveys made by independent fact-finding organizations, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. That fact was brought to light a few years ago when 113,597 doctors were asked this question: what cigarette do you smoke, doctor? The brand named most was Camel. In repeated surveys, doctors in all branches of medicine have been asked the same question. And each time, Camel leads all the rest. Yes, these surveys show that more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. Why don't you start smoking the cigarette so many doctors enjoy? Start smoking mild, flavorful Camels tonight.
How mild, how mild, how mild can a cigarette be? Take the Camel 30-day test and you see, smoke Camel's
tea. And now back to River Diamond, Private Detective, starring Dick Powell.
At the city morgue, I looked down on the girl who was once called Lee Thorpe and had now become a number. It wasn't a pretty sight, and I wasn't glad to be seeing it.
Okay, Charlie, thanks. Come on, Rick.
Where did you find her, Walt?
One of the beat men came across in an alley over by 6th Street.
Find the murder weapon?
No, the knife wasn't around, only the holes it made. Yeah, we can sit down in here. You have some talking to do, Rick. No more of this confidential rigmarole.
Okay, Walt. You ask the questions and I'll answer as best I can.
Number one, why were you looking for the dame?
Client hired me to find her.
Who's the client?
You know, Walt, this is going to sound screwy.
Cut the build-up. Just make with the answer.
Okay, okay. The client is Hank Burton.
Well, at least we... What? Hank Burton?
That's right. Now, sit down, fatty, and wipe that shocked expression off your face.
Rick, boy, do you happen to know who Hank Burton is? That we've been after him for 2 months?
I know, I know. And if things had gone as I planned, you'd have had him in a cell by tomorrow. I guess I'd better explain, Walt.
Yeah, I think you'd better. And make it good, Rick. Plenty good.
I told Walt about Burton, about the $1,000 fee, and Burton's illness. He wasn't happy about the whole thing, but at least he now knew as much about the case as I did, which wasn't much for either of us to know.
So Burton figured the gal gave him the double cross, huh?
Yeah, I guess that's it. He wanted me to find her, just so he could turn her in when he gives himself up.
Maybe and maybe not. Maybe he found her before you did. Maybe he's the one who put those knife wounds in her back.
I doubt it, Walt. If he'd had any idea where she was, he wouldn't have bothered to hire me.
Then why was she killed?
Well, she must have known where $50,000 worth of jewelry was. Good enough reason?
Yeah. Well, what now? You think Burton will still turn himself in after he hears the girl's dead?
I think so. He's pretty sick. Hasn't got a chance on his own.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm going back over the neighborhood where we found the girl's body. We figure she lived around there. Maybe we can find out where. It's a start, anyway.
Good. I'll wait for Hank Burton to contact me.
Okay. And, Rick, if you turn up anything, let me in on it this time, huh?
I waited until 6 o'clock in my office, and then Burton called. I didn't tell him about the girl over the phone. Instead, I made a date to meet him an hour later on the Christopher Street Ferry. The ferry was in when I arrived at the slip, so I went aboard. I agreed to meet Burton on the lower level, port side. I went there, sat down on one of the benches. But 5 minutes later, the ferry pulled out, and there was still no sign of Hank Burton.
Diamond?
Huh?
It's me, Shrimp.
Oh, that's quite a professional way you have of sneaking up on people, friend.
Yeah. Enjoy the ride, Diamond. We go over to Jersey, then we come back. And then we get off.
Where's Burton?
He couldn't make it. I want you to meet him back at the warehouse we met in this morning.
Oh, great. Why didn't you get here before we pulled out?
I tried. Not as fast as I used to be.
Uh-huh. Now, tell me, Shrimp, just why couldn't Hank make it here? It's as safe as that warehouse.
Oh, well, he's sick. He's feeling bad. He felt bad all day.
Oh? It didn't sound so bad when I talked to him on the phone.
Well, he was sick. He was. Real pain. He could never make it down here. Let's enjoy the ride, huh?
Let's talk some more first. If Burton knew he was too sick to meet me here, why did he suggest it in the first place?
How should I know? Hank says we come to the warehouse, we go to the warehouse. Don't ask him any questions.
Oh, I just have an inquisitive nature. I like answers, Shrimp.
Okay. How's this for an answer?
Wow. Little man with a big gun.
That's right. And the gun says we go to the warehouse. Now settle back and enjoy the ride.
It was the most uncomfortable boat ride I'd taken in years. Shrimp put the gun back in his pocket, but kept it pointed toward me. The ferry finally returned to the New York side, and we got off. Then we drove back to Front Street and parked beside the warehouse.
Okay, Diamond, in the back door.
Well, stop waving the gun back and forth, Shrimp. You'll wear yourself out.
No cracks. Go on, open the door.
Where's Burton?
Same place, over behind those boxes. Move.
I still don't get it, Shrimp. Why wouldn't Hank come to the ferry, and why the artillery to make sure I came here?
That's far enough. I'll light this candle, Don. Maybe you'll get your answer then.
Well, that's better. At least I... Oh.
See what I mean, Shamus?
Yeah, Shrimp. I see what you mean. Hank Burton wasn't bothered by his heart anymore. He lay there on the floor with a stupid expression on his face that the sudden dead often wear. His eyes were open in a bewildered stare, and his teeth were clenched tight. Hank Burton had died quickly, without warning. And it looked like I was next in line.
Surprise, Diamond?
You didn't bring me here for a reaction, Shrimp.
Uh-huh. I just get a kick out of seeing your face.
Yeah. Good old Shrimp, the loyal friend. Hank trusted you. Ah, that was a big mistake.
Hank was a sap. I stuck with him because I thought he'd get his hands on them rocks again. Then I'd get a split.
Only Hank didn't want the stuff back, huh? He was going to let me turn him in, and that left you out in the cold.
You got it right. When I knew he was sticking you onto the dame, I went to the guy who already has the stones.
Yeah, I figured there was someone else in this. You're not brave enough to try something like murder alone.
He does very well at it, Diamond, believe me.
Well, Pool Hall Thorpe, little Davy. You're a long way from your pool room, pal.
Yes, more profitable things than pool rooms, Diamond.
I saw it would seem. Like handling stolen jewelry.
Uh-huh. You sure no one followed you, Shrimp?
Positive.
Good. I'm sorry about this, Diamond, but... You'll have to join Hank before long.
Yeah, I'll bet you're sorry. You were sorry when you killed your ex-wife, too. A real sweet guy. She brings you the stones, and you pay her back with a knife.
And what can I do? Shrimp tells me there's a detective looking for her. Well, he was a good kid, but she didn't have much knife. She'd have talked her head off if you'd found her.
I see. But why Hank and now me?
Well, look at it this way. We finish you with the same knife that killed Lee. Then we put the knife in Hank's hand and the gun that killed him in yours.
Oh, that's really great. Davy, I'm afraid you've been reading Pulp Fiction.
Sir, the cops get wise sooner or later. It'll still give us time to get far away. Shrimp, you got the knife?
Right here, Davy.
Okay. We stall long enough, Shrimp.
By candlelight yet, huh, fellas? Well, this is real romantic.
Yeah, ain't it, though?
Only not quite enough. It's even more romantic with a candle. Oh.
Shrimp!
He's taking a little nap, Davy, and I've got his gun.
What?
It's too bad, Davy. You should have stuck to your pool room. Okay, Shrimp, get to your feet.
Diamond.
Oh, shut up. Come on.
Oh, my head.
Shrimp, I made you a promise this morning.
What?
I said either this deal with Hank was on the level or your buck teeth were going down your throat.
Oh, no, look, Diamond.
Oh, shut up. Now, you know the old saying, Shrimp. See your dentist twice a year.
Huh?
Well, you won't have to worry about that now, friend. Yes, Helen, dear?
It's nice outside.
If you're wearing a fur coat, it is.
Oh, it's not really cold. Besides, you have a heavy coat.
Helen, are you hinting that I should leave?
Uh-huh. With me. I'd still like to go for that walk.
Oh, no.
Well, why not? The only time I see you is after a case. Then you just drop in, seat yourself at the piano, and take it easy.
But, honey, I'm tired.
Well, I'm not. I've been in all day, and I could use the exercise.
Exercise, you want, huh? Now, I got a good idea. I'll chase you around the piano.
It's your idea of exercise, huh?
No, but just think of the fun we're going to have after I caught you.
Rick, I'm serious. Just look out that window. Oh, stop shivering. Look at that moonlight. Isn't it romantic?
What chances to give the Dodgers this year?
Long walk. Just you and me.
And the Giants. Now, there's a hot ball team. Hmm?
Maybe over to Central Park.
And the Arkansas Aggies. Oh, they'll be fighting all the way.
Hand in hand. We get Arkansas Aggies.
Yeah. My old home team.
Richard Diamond, you are the most unromantic man in town.
Helen, how can you say that? Don't I build a nice fire in the fireplace?
I could get a Boy Scout to do that.
Millions of girls in New York, and I had to pick a nature lover.
The story of Dr. Kildare.
Whatsoever house I enter, there will I go for the benefit of the sick. Whatsoever things I see or hear concerning the life of men, I will keep silence thereon, counting such things to be held as sacred trusts. I will exercise my art solely for the cure.
The story of Dr. Kildare, starring Lou Ayres and Lionel Barrymore. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer brought you those famous motion pictures. Now this exciting, heartwarming series is heard on radio. In just a moment, the story of Dr. Kildare. But first, your announcer. Now, the story of Dr. Kildare, starring Lou Ayres as Dr. Kildare and Lionel Barrymore as Dr. Gillespie.
Blair General Hospital, one of the great citadels of American medicine. A clump of gray-white buildings planted deep in the heart of New York. The nerve center of medical progress, where great minds and skilled hands wage man's everlasting battle against death and disease. Blair General Hospital, where life begins, where life ends, where life goes on.
Of course it's your business, Jimmy, your problem.
But if you tell Carew you won't do it, he'll tear his gardenia off and stamp on it with both feet.
Then look out for flying petals, Dr. Gillespie, because I'm not going to do it.
Well, no, no, he might stamp on you, too.
That I can't help. I've got a patient waiting in emergency, and as far as I'm concerned, that's more important than any of your specially conducted tour.
Not to Carew, at least not when a wealthy patron is about to make a donation.
Well, after all, that's his problem. I'm a doctor, not a promoter. Let me see. I better...
Oh, confound it, Jimmy. After all, Carew is the superintendent of this hospital.
You? Taking his side? I don't believe it.
Well, now I'm thinking of your career. I never played hospital politics. You know, that's true. But maybe I should have. Look where I ended up.
Only the world's greatest diagnostician. Too bad you couldn't have been a success.
Well, but there are different kinds of success. Now, you take Carew.
You take him.
All right, but come in.
Well, gentlemen.
Speak of the devil.
The devil? Oh, I really fail to see what... Oh, there you are, Dr. Kildare.
Yes, but I'm leaving right now, Dr.
Just a moment, please. You do have an assignment, you know.
Enough. Showing some millionaire's secretary around the operating room. Sorry, I haven't the time.
And precisely what is this case you consider so important, may I ask?
Some poor fellow collapsed down the street, and they brought him in here a little while ago. He's still unconscious.
Why, it's a heart condition, obviously. The intern can deal with it.
Well, it was the intern who called me, Dr. Carew. He's scared, and I know how he feels. Well, I'll see you later.
Dr. Kildare, I positively and absolutely forbid you to... Did you see that?
See what, Carew?
Insubordination, Dr. Gillespie. Rank insubordination.
Nonsense. Kildare has a patient waiting, that's all.
A patient? When I have a representative, a Mr. Jeremiah Ramsey, coming right here to this office any minute...
Not really.
Oh, yes, indeed. Mm. And I'm quite sure we can expect a $500,000 donation or more if we can show clearly the hospital needs it.
Well, I've never seen a time Blair Hospital didn't need it, or any other hospital, for that matter.
But I was counting on Dr. Kildare to, well, explain things. I've been away from actual practice for some time, you know, and after all, my talents do run more to administrative lines.
Yeah, heaven help the patient who ever had to depend on your medical talents.
See?
That's true. Miss Mudd out here to see you.
Miss Mudd?
She says she'd like to look over the hospital.
Oh, dear.
Well, Carew, your millionaire secretary has apparently arrived.
Oh, dear, 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 dear. Miss Parker, please ask her to wait a few minutes.
Very well, doctor.
Well, Carew?
Dr. Gillespie, I wonder if I could prevail on you to...
Don't look at me.
But somebody has to convince her we need that donation.
And since there are only two of us left...
Oh, dear, 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 dear. Oh, dear.
Parker, hand me that stethoscope again, will you?
Here you are, Dr. Kildare.
Well, it certainly isn't a hot condition, as Carew calls it. You can take a look at that thermometer now.
All right, doctor.
Good thing young Benton called me. If this had been handled as a routine
97.4.
Abnormal. Let me see now. Oh, there's a slight precipitate beginning to form here.
What do you think's wrong with him, Dr. Kildare?
Well, it isn't a heart attack. I wonder if he could possibly... Come in. Oh, Benson, yes.
Brought his wallet and things up from the office, Dr. Kildare. Is there any change yet?
No, none of any importance, but I think I know what's wrong. Let me see now. Yes, if I'm right, there should be... Here we are.
What is that?
If bearer is found unconscious, notify nearest physician immediately. Give no stimulants...
So that's what it is.
Uh-huh. Diabetic coma. Parker, get 20 units of insulin from the dispensary, and hurry.
And here is our number 3 operating room, Miss Mudd. After you.
Thank you, Dr. Carew.
And like the others, this room, too, is utterly inadequate.
You don't say so.
Oh, yes, indeed, utterly. As, of course, you can see for yourself.
Well, I don't know. I think you're underrating your institution, doctor.
Oh, my dear. Look, the lighting. Absolutely preposterous.
I'd say it was average. Possibly a little better.
Oh, good heavens, no. The lighting over this operating table would never pass inspection by the state board.
Indeed.
Of course, it's nothing that a few thousand dollars wouldn't take care of.
Oh, well, if that's all that's needed...
Yes, Miss
Then I would certainly think an institution this size could manage it somehow.
Oh, well, that's only for this room, and only for the lighting. Actually, the whole hospital is in horrible condition.
Oh, Dr. Carew, you must be exaggerating.
Exaggerating? My dear Miss Mudd, do you realize that our equipment is so obsolete, our supply is so limited, that we're unable to maintain even the minimum sanitary standard required by law?
What?
Oh, yes.
Shocking. Dr. Carew, I have never been so amazed in my life. Tell me more.
Oh, come in, Jimmy, come in. How's your emergency patient?
Oh, I think he's out of danger now. He's diabetic, you know.
Oh, coma, huh?
Mm-hmm. We gave him the regular insulin and a balanced shot of protamine zinc. Benton's staying with him, and I'm going back later. I suppose Carew was a little put out.
Only to the extent of turning pale pink and calling it rank insubordination.
He'll probably tear my insignia off in front of the assembled staff.
Jimmy, you've got to learn to take these things more seriously.
Oh?
Well, true enough, Carew is an imbecilic nincompoop.
Granted.
But nevertheless, he can do you a lot of harm professionally.
Look, Dr. Gillespie, you know I went into medicine for several reasons, but mainly just because it's the best way I know of helping people. Mm. And as far as I'm concerned, the only professional harm that could happen to me would be to change that idea.
Kildare, that's rank idealism.
You know where I learned it.
If you mean from me, that's different. Mm. I've been at this hospital since time immemorial. So I can afford to be a cantankerous rebel. You can't.
Maybe not. But I still believe the first consideration in medicine always is the welfare of the patient.
Yeah, sure, I agree with you. But...
Oh, I know the hospital needs money, too, and unfortunately a big part of it has to come from donations. Okay. But I still think...
I have no argument with you at all. You're absolutely right. Mm. But, confound it, why can't you be a little more diplomatic with Carew?
You really mean that?
Why, of course. Pull his whiskers. I don't care what you do.
Well, I'm back, Dr. Gillespie, in case you need me.
Parker, every time you're away for an hour, I'm reminded just how little I do need you for anything.
Well!
You'd make a good, horrible example for Carew's sales talk. Why, Miss Mudd would take one look at
Miss
you and...
Miss Mudd?
Quite a name, isn't it?
And Carew thinks that she's a representative from his wealthy patron.
Why, yes.
Come on, Dr. Gillespie, before it's too late. We've got to find Carew.
Oh, yes, gentlemen. Miss Mudd just left, went out to lunch. She'll be back later, of course. She was most impressed by the things I told her.
Yeah, imagine she was. Well, Kildare?
Just what kind of things did you tell her, Dr. Carew?
Well, now, of course, I may have gilded the lily just a bit, overemphasized the rundown condition of our equipment, hinted at slight irregularities in our ethical standards due to lack of funds, but all in the good cause, Dr. Kildare, if I may take occasion to remind you.
I see. Then I take it you're entirely satisfied with what you've accomplished. Feel now that it's just as well I didn't talk to this woman.
Well, far be it from me, Dr. Kildare, but I really do doubt that you could have done quite as good a job of selling.
Go on, Kildare. There, slipping the business. I can't wait.
Slip me the business?
Dr. Carew, you'd better hang on to something. You see, Miss Mudd is not who you think.
She's not? Well, then, who is? I mean, where is Mr. Ramsey's representative?
Well, it sounds very much as though he's the man I've had waiting downstairs in the lobby all morning.
What?
Anyway, a Mr. Grunion sent word up that he wanted to look over the hospital.
And you kept him waiting all morning? We're ruined. Mm-hmm. Absolutely ruined.
Oh, that isn't the worst of it, Dr. Carew. There's still Miss Mudd.
Oh, dear, I'd forgotten her.
And apparently you've also forgotten the announcement of her appointment a few months ago. She's one of the new examiners for the State Board of Hospitals.
Really? Well, in that case, I suppose I better... Oh, heaven help me.
Yeah, you'll need help from somewhere.
But you don't realize all the things I told her.
We can imagine.
I said we were violating sanitary regulations, ignoring fire codes, paying no attention whatsoever to institutional law. Good heavens.
Carew, stop spinning.
But we're ruined. Absolutely ruined.
Oh, I don't think it's that serious. She'll make a report to the Board of Regents. They'll throw you out, of course.
Throw me out?
But after that, things should settle back to normal.
Normal, you say? Normal? I won't see anyone. I won't see anyone.
Arthur Carew, get a hold of yourself.
Cast aside like an old fool, and my poor wife, she just ordered new drapes for the dining room.
Fine. Be nice for the new superintendent.
After all the years I've given to Blair Hospital, the best years of my life, but... Oh, Dr. Kildare, it's all your fault.
My fault? Now, really?
Sorry to butt in, fellas, but I got kind of tired of waiting down there. My name's Grunion.
Mr. Grunion, I just now learned of the atrocious treatment you were given this morning, and I want to offer you, nay, beg you to accept my abject apologies and humble assurances.
Stop licking Mr. Grunion's boots.
What's wrong with him? One of the mental cases?
No. Dr. Carew is our former superintendent.
Please. You're kidding.
No, really. You see, he takes the patient's troubles so much to heart that sometimes it's just too much for him.
Now,
Mr. Grunion, if you don't mind waiting outside, I'm sure he'll be all right in a few minutes.
But I've been waiting up.
Well, now, what are we going to do?
Carew, you're a fathead.
No, dear.
We return to the story of Dr. Kildare in just a moment. Now we continue with the story of Dr. Kildare, starring Lou Ayres as Dr. Kildare and Lionel Barrymore as Dr. Gillespie.
Ah, what a morning.
Yeah, things have been a little hectic, all right.
Dr. Gillespie, I'll give you 10-1. We made a mistake in letting Carew go off alone with that Mr. Onion or Grunion or whatever his name is.
Well, I don't know how we could have stopped him, Jimmy, without locking him up.
I guess not. He's all set to die for dear old Blair. To make one last gesture and hand over $500,000 along with his resignation.
Ah, the idiot.
Well, I've never seen anyone else in my life who could blunder into as many ways of doing the wrong thing.
He's a biological paradox. The only example known to medical science of a living human being born without a brain.
What on earth are you talking about, Dr. Gillespie?
My mistake, Jimmy. He is one of two examples. Well, what do you want, Parker?
You don't have to shout at me.
I don't even have to put up with you.
Well...
It's all right, Parker. He just has another mild case of Carewangitis.
Carewan what?
Never mind. How's the diabetic in 508?
He's conscious now. That's what I came to let you know.
Good.
Dr. Benton said to tell you that he's responding normally and can probably have something to eat about 2:30.
Fine. I'll drop by to see him right after lunch. Which, by the way, is a good idea. Well, my dear doctor, shall we go across to Sullivan's and risk ptomaine poisoning again?
No, you go ahead, Jimmy. You go on. I've got a halfway idea how we might straighten out the blunders Carew made when he talked to Miss Mudd.
Now, wait a minute. You're not starting to come up with brilliant schemes, too.
Well, no, something has to be done.
All right. Tell her the truth.
It isn't quite that simple.
It could be.
You just leave it to me, Jimmy. Now, 10 minutes conversation, I'll have everything all fixed up.
That's exactly what I'm afraid of. Parker?
Huh?
Parker, I'd like your opinion about something.
Oh, why, of course, Dr. Kildare.
Tell me, what do you think of a man who's prone to go off on tangents and violate his own principles?
If you're talking about who I think you are, well...
A man who has repeatedly claimed that a staff doctor should concern himself only with the medical affairs of the hospital and should stay away from the...
Fiddle-faddle, I think that's what he'd say.
Yes, stay away from the fiddle-faddle. Thanks, Parker.
Fiddle-faddle.
And then when you find that man doing exactly the opposite from what he believes... Well, how can you explain it?
Well, I guess you just can't, Dr. Kildare, unless, of course, he was born without a brain.
Born without a... Parker, you get out of here. Go on. Get...
All right. There are times when I wish he'd been born without vocal cords.
Parker! Confounded tarnation.
It's insubordination, Doctor. Rank insubordination. Well, give my regards to Carew when you get out on that same limb with him. I'm going to lunch.
Oh, indeed, Mr. Runyon. The lighting over this operating table is completely inadequate. You see?
Well, now, I don't know, Dr. Carew. It looks all right to me.
Oh, my dear sir, it's frightful. Really frightful. Of course, it's nothing that a few $1,000s wouldn't take care of.
$2,000, hmm?
That's only for the lights, and only in this one room.
I see. Well, it sounds like the place is in pretty bad shape.
Of course, a $500,000 isn't really very much to a wealthy and generous philanthropist.
No, I suppose not. You know, Dr. Carew, I'm frankly amazed. I had no idea the conditions were so bad here at Blair.
Mr. Runyon, you've only heard the beginning. Just wait until I get through.
Dr. Gillespie, do you mean to say that you went without your lunch and waited here for me to get back in order to tell me that?
Well, now, I think the information is fairly important, Miss Mudd. And, of course, it'd be impossible to tell you in front of him.
I see. Well, I imagine it might have been a good deal more shocking if I weren't partly prepared for it already. I suppose you are quite sure.
Oh, yes, of course. Ordinarily, he's quite normal, but he does have these spells when he gets nuttier than a walnut grove. Of course, we've all known about it all these years, you know.
Well, shouldn't something be done about it? I mean, after all, the superintendent of a big hospital like this...
Oh, he's perfectly harmless, yes, yes. The only symptom is that pessimism you saw this morning. He thinks the whole place is falling to ruin when actually it's running at the top efficiency.
Amazing. Dr. Gillespie, do you know that this is the most remarkable institution I have ever seen?
Yes.
Good afternoon, Benson. How's our patient?
Well, Dr. Kildare...
Young man, I'm quite capable of answering the question for myself.
Oh, you apparently are. Feeling all right, eh?
I haven't felt better since my 62nd birthday. Thanks to you, John Gold.
Oh, well, you've been told wrong. Dr. Benton's your physician. I'm only a consultant in the case.
Thanks to both of you, then.
Dr. Kildare, if you're going to be here a while, I think I'll grab some lunch.
Sure, sure, go ahead.
His response has been completely normal. I gave him 10 more units at 1 o'clock and ordered a standard DB lunch. It's due now.
All right, Benton, see you later.
Talk about a man like he's a dad-blamed specimen under a microscope.
Oh, but you're a live specimen, at least.
Yeah, good point. Very good point.
Of course, you won't be long if you go around skipping your insulin shots very often.
Well, a man gets careless at my age.
I know.
Worse than that, gets to be a dad-blamed fool. You wouldn't know.
Oh, well, I'd say you're a long way from being a fool.
Flattery, that's all. You a staff doctor here?
Guilty, Your Honor.
Getting rich at it, imagine.
Oh, yes, yes. I have a private annex at Fort Knox.
Young man, suppose I hadn't been a half block from a hospital when this happened.
Oh, but you were, so why suppose?
Yes, imagination's bad business. Have lunch with me, young fellow. I always hate to eat alone.
Sure, I'll have a cup of coffee. I like to watch a convalescent patient eat. Means he's recovering.
Means you'll get rid of him that much quicker, too. You know something, young man?
Hmm?
I think we understand each other.
You know something else? I think I agree with you.
Come in.
Dr. Carew, Dr. Gillespie, what are we holding here? Council of War or victory celebration?
Jimmy, it worked like a charm, just as I told you it would.
I see. Where are the sacrificial victims?
Mr. Runyon is making a phone call at the moment.
Miss Mudd's gone after some forms to be signed.
Dr. Gillespie is being coy, you know. He won't tell me what he said to her, but it must have been effective.
I'll bet it was.
And, of course, Mr. Runyon is... Thoroughly, so...
I suppose you gave him the same story you told Miss Mudd earlier today.
Oh, an even better one the second time. Everything is just wonderful, Dr. Kildare. Why, I'm even inclined to forgive your little peccadillo.
Thank you very much, Dr. Carew.
Oh, well, come in, Miss Mudd.
I'll just leave these with you, and you can mail them in.
Oh, Miss Mudd, I don't believe you've met...
Oh, hello, Dr. Kildare.
How are you, Miss Mudd?
You know each other?
Mm-hmm. We met at lunch over at Sullivan's.
Yes, we had a very interesting conversation. In fact, that's the only reason I'm giving the hospital a clean bill of health, so to speak.
What?
You see, Dr. Kildare told me the whole story. And after all, Dr. Carew, I couldn't see any of those terrible conditions you tried to point out.
Do you mean you already talked to Kildare when I was telling you about Carew being a mental case?
Dr. Gillespie.
Oh, yes. But I thought it was so cute to let you go on with it.
Cute?
Well, I suppose I really should go. I'm
sorry to keep you waiting, gentlemen.
Well, Mr. Grunion.
Well, Miss Mudd, imagine meeting you here. You two know each other.
Oh, yes, we met at the medical convention in Albany a few weeks ago.
Yes, we did. Yes, indeed. Yes.
Well, Mr. Grunion, I do hope you'll be able to convince Mr. Ramsey of our need.
Ramsey? Who's Mr. Ramsey?
Why, he's your Grunion. Who in heaven's name are you?
Field representative for the Pan-Acme Hospital Insurance Plan.
Oh, dear.
We had considered putting Blair Hospital on our preferred list.
Oh, dear.
But, of course, that's out now that I've learned about conditions.
Oh, dear.
Mr. Grunion, I think the boys have been giving you a rib. Maybe I can straighten the whole thing out.
Well, I do respect your opinion, Miss Mudd.
Well, come on, then. Let's go find a quiet spot and reminisce about Albany. See you again soon, Dr. Kildare.
I hope so. Goodbye, Miss Mudd.
Dr. Kildare, I hardly know what to say.
Carew, I think we both said too much already.
Mm. Well, since everything seems to be taken care of, I guess I'll just get back to work.
There's only one thing. I so counted on that donation from Mr. Ramsey. I wonder what could have happened to his...
Ramsey? Mm. Oh, Dr. Carew, I almost forgot. Mr. Ramsey should have all the arrangements completed and a check deposited to the hospital account by, the end of the week.
What?
Dr. Killian, how do you know?
He told me a little while ago. Soon as he recovered from his diabetic coma.
Oh, no.
You mean that emergency patient in 508? The one that you... Oh, dear.
He seems to be highly impressed by our efficiency and our concern for the welfare of the patients. Maybe overly impressed.
I must go lie down. I must go and take an aspirin or something.
Well, then, Jimmy.
Oh, Dr. Gillespie, I was just lucky.
Confounded.
Oh, now, don't say it.
But I... All right.
In just a moment, we will return to the story of Dr. Kildare. Once again, the story of Dr. Kildare, starring Lou Ayres as Dr. Kildare and Lionel Barrymore as Dr. Gillespie.
Dr. Gillespie, I've got all these forms filled out now for the State Hospital Board. If you'd like to sign them, we'll get them sent off.
Love to sign them, Jimmy. I hope you've included our best regards to Miss Mudd.
Oh, yes. Enclosed a personal note.
Personal, huh? I hope you asked her to say hello to Mr. Grunion just in passing. Maybe at some Albany convention.
I mentioned his name.
Good. Well, here you are. And may they both rest in peace.
Allowing for your exaggerated metaphors, I guess I agree with you. A mix-up like that once a year is plenty.
Dr. Gillespie, there's a Mr. Beetlepuss here to see you.
Beetlepuss? Never heard of him, Parker.
Well, he says he wants to look over the hospital. Dr. Kildare, what are you doing under that desk? Dr. Gillespie, get down off that coat rack.
Parker, why does he want to look over the hospital?
Well, because he works for the phone company, and he has to know where the new telephones are supposed to go.
Jimmy, you go with him.
Not me, Parker. Take Mr. Beetlepuss upstairs and introduce him to Dr. Carew.
You have just heard the story of Dr. Kildare, starring Lou Ayres and Lionel Barrymore. This program was written by Les Crutchfield and directed by William P. Russo. Original music was composed and conducted by Walter Schumann. Supporting cast included Virginia Gregg, Ted Osborne, Isabel Jewell, Will Wright, and Wilms Herbert. Dick Joy speaking. Creaking door for another Inner Sanctum mystery, and remind you to
buy Eddie three ways.
You to meet some new guests we've just dug up. Now, that peculiar cadaver standing off the corner by himself has a serious case of claustrophobia. Mm-hmm. Poor Stiff, he just can't stand shrouds. Now, this fellow here arrived with a mountain climber in life. He took his wife on an alpine hike, and while they were going up an icy slope, he cut the rope that held them together. Said he just couldn't stand being tied to one woman. And now, meet our most forgettable character, Wild-Eyed Willie. One day, Willie's ugly wife bit him. So, in anger, he buried her in the backyard. 6 months later, his homely mate came up as a dogwood tree to haunt him. Now, according to Willie, her bark is much worse than her bite.
Tonight's Inner Sanctum mystery, The Vengeful Corpse, was written by Ed Adamson and Bob Sloan and stars Barbara Weeks in the role of Sarah with Carl Swenson as Paul. Inner Sanctum is presented by the Emerson Drug Company of Baltimore, Maryland, makers of Bromo Seltzer. Remember, Bromo Seltzer is compounded by registered pharmacists. It fights headache three ways.
Bromo Seltzer helps your headache quickly, pleasantly, and it also soothes the upset stomach and jangled nerves that may team up with it.
No wonder druggists report that of all headache products dispensed to their fountains, the overwhelming favorite is Bromo Seltzer.
Please, friends, absolute silence. We want it so quiet you can hear a head. In a small hillside New England cemetery, a chill evening wind stirs the leafless trees with a complaining murmur. A blood-red moon probes through the branches with grotesque fingers, touching the faded headstones with their eerie light. The frail, drawn-faced young woman sits on an old stone bench, listening acutely to the rustling of the branches, as if to capture some word whisper of the dead, forgotten past.
Sarah! Sarah!
Ma?
Sarah, where are you?
Oh, Paul, I'm here, over here.
Sarah, I've been looking all over for you. What are you doing out here anyway?
I was cold out here, Paul.
What?
The wind. There was a voice on the wind, and it called me to come out here.
That's just in your mind, darling. No voice called you.
Yes, Paul, it did. I recognized the voice.
You recognized it? Then whose voice was it, dear?
It was old and tired and sort of cracked. And yet I could recognize it as my own voice.
You heard your own voice?
Yes, and it was strongest right here where I'm sitting now, among my family graves.
Hello there!
Oh, my boy.
Hello!
It's just Mr. Griffin, the caretaker. I asked him to help me look for you.
Oh, well, I see you found your wife all right, eh, Mrs. Eaton?
Yes, I found her, Mr. Griffin.
I thought I saw Mrs. Eaton come to the graveyard here earlier. I didn't expect she'd still be...
Well, what's wrong? What's the matter, Mr. Griffin?
Just that I get sort of a funny kind of feeling every time I pass this grave here.
What do you mean? What are you talking about?
That grave, that one there, the one right next to you.
Why? What's the matter with him?
Well, ain't you notice there's only one name on the headstone? The first name, Hester.
That's strange. My family name is Randall. Wasn't this woman a Randall?
Oh, you don't know the story.
What story are you talking about?
The kin who buried this Hester woman didn't think she deserved the family name, so they left it off the headstone.
Why? Why didn't they give Hester her full name?
Because they didn't want anybody to know who she was, I guess. You see, Hester was burned at the stake for witchcraft.
Witchcraft?
That's what they say.
Mr. Griffin, my wife is an ill woman as it is.
Let him go on, Paul.
No, but Sarah...
What else, Mr. Griffin?
Well, that's all, Mrs. Seaton, except that Hester claimed at the stake that they were burning an innocent woman. She could be heard shouting it as the flames licked around her. She threatened with her last breath to get even someday.
How could she get even?
I don't know, but according to the story I heard, Hester said that this here town owed her the years of her life that they took away.
Well, now, this is completely ridiculous. It's only a legend.
Mr. Griffin, no... tell me, how many years ago did all this happen?
Well, it's right here on the headstone. You see, Hester, a lost soul, born October the 13th, 1759, died... Good heavens.
What's wrong?
Look, Mrs. Seaton, the date of Hester's death, it's worn away.
Sarah?
Yes, Paul.
What are you doing out of bed? When did you get up?
Why, just a minute ago. I can't sleep. She keeps calling me. I hear her voice right here in this room. Just a few minutes ago.
What?
She was begging me to help her, telling me she never really lived and pleading with me to bring her back to life.
Sarah.
I thought I saw her.
No, Sarah. Believe me.
She was dressed in a black dress and there was a large W on it. That's the witch. And in her hand she held a flaming torch.
I'm going to call the doctor, darling.
Someone's at the door.
All right, I'll see who it is.
No, wait. I'll go.
Good evening, Mrs. Seaton.
Why, Judge Foster.
I hope I didn't awaken you folks. I saw a light in the window.
Oh, that's all right, Judge. Come right in.
Thank you. Sorry to bother you this time of the night, Mr. Seaton, but I was looking out of my window on the other side of the cemetery, and I thought I saw something or someone prowling around out there, and I wondered if they'd come over this way.
Who was it?
I don't know. Someone carrying a torch.
A torch?
Go on, Judge.
Well, of course, it could be that my eyes were playing tricks on me. They're not so good. But as far as I could make out, it was a woman dressed in black.
Paul.
You saw this woman, Judge? You're sure?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I saw her. Of course, it's kind of dark out there, but it looked to me like there was something on the front of her dress.
What do you mean?
Well, there was the letter W. A big white letter W on it.
It was Hester, just as
No, Sarah.
Hester? Who's Hester?
Hester Randolph. That's who you saw. She was in this house,
too. No, it must be a trick. You see, someone is trying to frighten you to make you worse.
Now, hold on, folks. Hester Randolph was buried over 100 years ago.
She's come back to life.
Mrs. Seaton.
Judge, my wife is ill. She doesn't realize what she's saying.
I know Hester's alive. You didn't believe me, Paul, but Judge Foster saw her, too.
Well, I didn't see anybody who's been dead 100 years.
What is it, son?
Don't you smell it?
Yes.
Something burning.
It's the odor of burning flesh.
Look. Out there on the back lawn. Stuck in the earth. A torch. A flaming torch.
Paul.
I tell you, it's useless to have me dig up this grave.
I've got to know, Kenny. It's the only way I'll be sure.
Well, careful, Mr. Seaton. You're just about deep enough for the coffin now, if it's still there.
Judge, I don't know how you can sanction a thing like this.
Well, Mr. Seaton, you see, I want to be sure, too.
But it's ridiculous.
You've struck wood with the shovel. Yes, it's the coffin, all right. Better go easy now. That wood is soft with age and half rotted away.
Now, I think we can open it now.
Wait, I'll give you a hand with the lid.
There's something inside it.
The body. Charred.
It's a body, all right. Only it isn't a woman's. You can still make out the face. It's Griffin, the caretaker.
Dr. Norton, I am so glad that you've gotten here.
I came as soon as I could, Mr. Seaton. What's wrong?
She's worse, Doctor.
Oh?
Much worse. Been in a room all day, hiding like a frightened child. I think the reading made her worse.
Reading? What reading?
Well, for the past few days, she's been reading books about her family history.
Why did you let her have them?
Well, because at first, they seemed to quiet her. Since the night we found Mr. Griffin's body in that grave, she's wanted to know more and more about Hester Randolph.
Paul!
Oh, Sarah. Dr. Norton's here, dear.
You've got to warn him, Paul, before it's too late.
Warn whom, Mrs. Seaton?
Judge Foster. He's in danger. Hester will kill him next.
What?
It's in the records of the court. The magistrate who sentenced Hester to death at the stake was a man named Foster.
Now, Mrs. Seaton, you're just upset.
Please, believe me. Judge Foster is a direct descendant of that magistrate.
Sarah, Hester's dead, dear. The dead can do no harm.
Paul, you don't understand. She's killed one man already, and now she's going to kill another. She swore she'd get that revenge on the magistrate and on the man who was her accuser.
Mrs. Seaton, all this took place over 100 years ago.
Then what about Mr. Griffin?
Well, what do you mean, Sarah?
He had the same name, too. According to the record, Hester's accuser was a man named Richard Griffin.
So, Judge Foster, my wife insisted that I come over here and warn you about Hester.
Well, thank you, Mr. Seaton, for troubling, but I'm not a bit worried about the similarity of names.
Well, I didn't admit it to Sarah, but the coincidence with Griffin was strange.
Well, the dead never frightened me, Mr. Seaton. But thank you for coming over. Oh, by the way, can I drive you home?
No, thanks. Dr. Norton is waiting for me outside. Good night.
Good night, Mr. Seaton. Now, where did I put those glasses of mine? Sure, I left them here on the table. Wait. Say, who opened that door? Is that you come back, Mr. Seaton? But confound it, whoever it is, answer me. Who's out there? Who is it? What? Who are you?
Your conscience has been dimmed by the evil of your acts. Who am I? Mark you well this torch I light. Now mark you also my God. This black garment I wear and upon which you had impressed the wicked lips. W.
Hester.
Aye, Satan's magistrate, Hester Randolph.
You are listening to Inner Sanctum, brought to you by...
Glad we've got some Broma Seltzer home.
More and more people are turning to Broma Seltzer all the time because it fights headache fast and fights it all three ways. First, it quickly fights the pain of the headache itself.
Then it soothes upset stomach and jumpy nerves that may often team up with a headache.
That's right, folks. Broma Seltzer does three jobs fast and pleasantly. Just put a teaspoonful of Broma Seltzer in a glass and add water. It fizzes immediately, sparkling and refreshing, ready to help your headache all three ways.
Why wait, folks?
keep that familiar blue bottle handy at home and at your place of business.
Yes, friends, it's smart to be prepared for headaches at all times with Bromo Seltzer. It's on sale at all drugstores. Get a bottle today or tomorrow. Simply ask for...
Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer, Bromo Seltzer.
Hester character. You know, that's the way a dame gets when she's burned up. Makes a specter of herself. You know, folks, I kind of feel sorry for old Judge Foster. When Hester showed up, the poor guy didn't know which way to turn. To turn away which. They should have believed Sarah Seaton. She sure had Hester dead. Rather alive to ride. Yes, indeed, it's a wise descendant who knows her own forebears. Particularly the grave-minded one. Well, now, let's get back to our flaming fable and see what's cooking for the next stanza.
Paul, wake up. Mm. Oh, please, wake up.
Oh, Sarah. What's the matter, Donnie?
I've just had a terrible dream. I'm afraid.
No, dear.
I dreamt that Judge Foster was killed tonight. By Hester. You did warn Judge Foster, didn't you, Paul?
Yes, of course, sir. Where are you going, dear?
I'm getting dressed. I'm going down to tell the judge myself.
You are staying here.
Oh, please, no. Please let me go. It means a man's life.
You heard what Dr. Norton said, dear. Under no circumstances are you to leave the house. You're to talk to no one.
Why am I being kept here like a prisoner? Why don't you let me speak to you? Oh, what was that?
Sounded like a door banging in the wind. Yes. There it is again.
In the rear of the house. Didn't you lock that back door?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure I did. I'd better see what happened.
Wait, I'm going with you. I'd better turn on a light here in the kitchen.
No, you won't have to. I can see. It's the door, all right. Guess I must have forgotten to spring the latch fast.
Paul!
Sarah, what's the matter?
Out there. But the trees at the end of the lawn. I thought I saw a figure.
All right, you stay here, dear. I'll be right back. No one out here, Sarah.
You sure?
Positive. Probably just a shadow.
Whoa! There is someone right here!
Sarah! What happened? Sarah. Where are you? Sarah! She was standing here, Sheriff. Right here at the back door when I heard her scream.
And there wasn't a sign of her when you got back here at the door?
Not a sign of her.
Well, folks just don't vanish into thin air, Mr. Seaton. She must be around here someplace.
I've got to find her before it's too late.
Too late? What do you mean by that?
I don't know, really. I have a feeling that...
Oh, now you're not going to tell me about dead witches returning too, are you? Don't tell me you believe in that stuff.
I don't know what to believe.
Sheriff. Is that you, Sheriff?
Yes, who's there?
Dr. Norton. You'd better come with me, Sheriff. I just discovered something on the side of the road, about a mile away. Mr. Seaton, I think you'd better wait here.
What is it, Dr. Norton? What have you found?
I'd rather you'd wait, as I said before, until we're sure.
What are you trying to hide from me?
I guess you'd better speak up, Doctor. If it's something that concerns Mr. Seaton, maybe he should know.
All right, Sheriff. But I made the turn into the road. My headlights caught it in a ditch. I wasn't sure at first, so I stopped the car and got out. It was a body in the ditch. A charred body. Sheriff. Over here to the right.
Where is she?
Easy now, Mr. Seaton.
Right here, Sheriff.
Oh, wait, I'll switch on the flashlight.
Sarah.
Just a moment, Mr. Seaton. Dr. Norton has made a mistake.
What?
This corpse isn't your wife. I can tell by that ring. It's the ring that Judge Foster always wore.
Hello. Oh, yes, Sheriff. Any news yet? Well, why can't your men find her? It's been 6 hours already. No, I haven't heard a word. Yes. Please call me as soon as you hear anything, will you? Who's there? Who is it?
Oh, open the door. Hurry.
Sarah.
Yes, yes. Quick, let me in.
Oh, Sarah, Sarah, thank the Lord you're all right.
Oh, no.
Darling, where have you been? What happened to you?
Wait, lock the door quickly.
You...
She doesn't know I've come back. She's still looking for
who?
Me. Hester. She was out there, Paul. That's why I ran from the house. She called to me from the road. Made me go with her.
Go where?
To the cemetery. She kept me there, torturing me. Taking me to change places with her.
Darling, you're not making a stand.
Please, please, believe me. We've got to get away from here tonight. Right now. She'll kill me if we don't. She wants my life for the one she never lived.
Now, stop it. Stop. Now, get hold of yourself. There is no such woman as Hester Randolph.
But I saw her. I spoke to her.
The woman you saw is somebody else, somebody living, who wants you to believe that she's Hester. She wants everybody to believe it.
But... Why, Paul, why?
Because she's a cold-blooded murderess. She's killed 2 people already, and she's trying to drive you out of your mind completely.
Then who? Who could it be?
I wasn't sure before. Now I'm almost positive. It's Dr. Norton.
Dr. Norton?
Now, you saw this Hester, Sarah. What was she like?
Oh, like a ghost.
Hmm?
Like a shadow in the light. You can see her face, and yet... You can see through it. Beyond.
No. That was just an illusion created by the nightmare. And perhaps some other tricks of a clever, scheming woman. You'll see. I'll prove that Dr. Norton is... That's the back door, sir. That's blown open again.
Leave it! We've got to get out of here!
No, no, you stay here. I'm going to see who opened that door.
Please, hurry. Don't leave me alone so long. Please, not for a moment.
Oh. What is it, Dad?
Don't come in here! Don't come in here! I'll run away as fast as you can!
What's the matter?
Don't come in here! Leave here! Esther!
Sarah!
The ghost! I'm on the ground! I'm dead! Come back and go!
Sarah! Sarah! Are you all right?
I've killed her, Paul. She won't torture me anymore. I killed Hester. She came toward me and I fired.
Sarah, there's no one in this room, dear.
Over there. In the hall. She's there.
Where? I don't see her. Good Lord, you've broken the mirror.
What?
You shot it yourself.
No. It can't be. I can't be her. And yet I saw her face.
But it was my face, too.
Sarah, it was you. You all the time.
I'm Hester, fair gentleman. It is warming to have such a friend as you to stand beside me in this mockery of justice.
Oh, Sarah.
Run. Run as fast as you can, Paul. I was wrong. I haven't killed her. Run!
Sarah, I've got to help you. I've got to explain to you that
you... But I'm not Sarah. Not anymore. Can't you see who I am? Can't you see who's taken my place?
Sarah, listen to me. I love you. Please, please, come back to me.
Sarah's gone. Now I can live the years they took from me.
Sarah!
See in my hand this pistol. He will bid it, I say. He will come with me.
Still no answer, Sheriff.
No answer, Dr. Norton. I can't understand it. Mr. Seaton was home when I called just 15 minutes ago.
I warned you, Sheriff, to have that house closely watched.
Well, I can't do 100 things at once. I've got every available deputy out looking for Mrs. Seaton.
Don't you realize she may have gone back to their house? Don't you realize that she's the one who might be Hester?
Mrs. Seaton, Hester, what the deuce are you talking about?
I'm talking about dual personality. Mrs. Seaton is suffering from a nervous breakdown. And it's entirely possible that she's the one who killed Griffin and Judge Foster.
Well, you should have told me this before, Doctor. Come on, we're getting right over to the Seaton house.
Here, Paul. They buried Hester's body here. Dishonored and unnamed. But, Paul, they believe in my innocence.
Yes, Sarah. We better go back, dear.
Back?
Yes, to the house. Very cold here.
It's cold everywhere, Paul. I feel the chill of death coming in me. You and I are going back. Back through time. To an age where no one can harm us. This torch, I hold, will free us forever.
No, wait. Now, Sarah, please, listen. Now, try to understand, dear.
Heal your mind, the flames will be of no pain. I know, because I've been through such a death before.
No. Now, Sarah, wait.
Paul. Paul. Hester's going.
Oh. Mr. Seaton, yeah. Are you all right?
Yes.
Looks like we've got here just in time.
Paul. She's going from me. Forever.
Oh, Sarah.
She's dead, Mr. Seaton.
I'm sorry, Mr. Seaton.
Sheriff.
What is it? What's the matter?
Look, the headstone. I didn't notice that before. It's been recut.
Oh, what do you mean?
Can you see what it says? Hester Randolph, a lost soul. Born October 13th, 1759. Died September 12th,
1949. Hey, have you had your personality split lately? You see what happens when a dame gets her dates mixed up? Poor Hester. She didn't know whether she was coming or going to the grave. Now, look, if you should be in an old New England cemetery some night and one of the headstones should move, don't be frightened. It's probably just Hester coming up for a hot date again. Oh, by the way, there's no parting moral attached to tonight's tale. I'll just leave you with your own thoughts, as horrible as I hope they are. Friends, it's so foolish to suffer with an ordinary headache when Bromo Seltzer gives you such fast, pleasant, three-way relief.
It's true, Mr. Wheat. Bromo Seltzer is so pleasant to take, and it works so fast to help your headache all three ways.
Yes, Bromo Seltzer speedily fights the headache pain itself. Then it goes right to work to soothe the upset stomach and jangled nerves that often may team up with a headache. Try it next time you get a headache. Prove to yourself just how fast it works to help your headache all three ways.
We've tried a lot of headache products, but it's Bromo Seltzer from now on for our family.
You'll say the same thing, too, once you've discovered Bromo Seltzer. So get a bottle today and be prepared at all times to fight a headache fast all three ways.
It's smart to keep Bromo Seltzer both at home and at your place of business.
That's right, folks. Remember, Bromo Seltzer gives you fast three-way help for a headache. It's on sale at all drugstores. Caution, use only as directed. If headaches recur or persist, see your doctor. Get Bromo Seltzer today and... Sanctum Mystery novel is Hanged by Your Neck by Henry. love story. It's all about a man who loves to kill and a woman who loves a murderer and a murderer who loves a woman. It's the eternal triangle, but dipped in blood. So won't you be with us when we take you on a honeymoon in a chamber of horrors? Until next Monday, then. Good night. Pleasant dreams. This is Dwight Wiest inviting you to tune in again next Monday at the same time to Inner Sanctum, which is brought to you for your entertainment every Monday by...
Brahma, Delta.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is Paul Jensen speaking. The picture we are about to watch, The Mummy, exemplifies what is best in the American horror films of the early 1930s. This is due to the skill and sensitivity of many people, but especially the film's star, Boris Karloff, its director, Carl Freund, and its screenwriter, John L. Balderston. Also making an important contribution is Karloff's co-star, Zita Johann, whose voice and looks are simultaneously exotic and natural, vulnerable and seductive. And we must not overlook the support provided by the other performers in this well-cast film, especially David Manners, Arthur Byron, Edward Van Sloan, and Bramwell Fletcher. John Balderston begins his story with an archaeological expedition in the Egypt of 1921. By doing so, he deliberately evokes the November 1922 discovery of Tutankhamun's unplundered tomb, a discovery which had tremendous impact on the popular press and the popular imagination, an impact that remained for quite a few years. Howard Carter's excavation of the tomb was methodical. Its inner chamber was not even opened until 3 months later. The pharaoh's mummy was not unwrapped until 1925. Artifacts were first displayed in Cairo's museum in 1929. And the tomb was not fully cleared until February 1932, just a month before Balderston began writing this film. Attracting a more sensational kind of attention was the tomb's supposed curse, which reporters invariably mentioned when anyone remotely connected with the expedition died. In 1926, a New York Times front page article quoted an Egyptologist as being, like Dr. Mueller in this film, absolutely convinced that the ancients could concentrate upon and around a mummy certain dynamic powers of which we possess very incomplete notions. As late as 1930, a Times article summarized the deaths of 14 people connected with Tutankhamun's tomb.
Trying to teach me a lesson in patience, Sir Judas?
Method is everything in archaeology, my boy. We always deal with our finds of the day in order.
In this shot and the next, note the lamp in the foreground. This is the kind of extra detail that gives visual interest to the images while making us aware of the object a short time before it will be used.
We didn't come to dig in Egypt for medals. Much more is learned from studying bits of broken pottery than from all the sensational finds.
These archaeologists have the task of informing us about the present situation, because most of the things we need to know are things the characters themselves are just learning. The exposition arises naturally. A great deal of information is offered gradually in stages, starting with general background about the expedition, presented through two contrasting attitudes to archaeology. Wemple, older and more experienced, advocates patience and method, while the younger Norton is excitable and impulsive. As it makes this contrast, the script happily resists any temptation to ridicule either viewpoint. Each man is sympathetic and understandable. After introducing Wemple and Norton and the general situation, the scene shifts our attention to Dr. Mueller and, through him, to the mummy. Both have been visible on the sidelines in a couple of earlier shots. Mueller notes that the viscera were not removed and the body was not embalmed. This man seems to have died in some sensationally unpleasant manner, struggling in his bandages. Clearly, he was buried alive. He probably was punished for some kind of sacrilege. The mummy is identified as that of Imhotep, high priest of the Temple of the Sun at Karnak. Miller also notes that the sacred spells that protect the soul in its journey into the underworld were chipped off. So Imhotep was sent to his death in the next world, too.
But in the next...
Maybe he got too gay with the Vestal Virgins in the temple.
Possibly. The priestesses of the Temple of Karnak were the daughters of the reigning pharaohs. They were the sacred virgins of Isis.
Maybe the answer's in that box we found buried with him.
Now attention shifts to a box on the foreground table. It is not an easy object to get at, causing a delay which builds anticipation. First, they must remove it from an outer wooden casing. Then they carry it to a new position.
Terribly heavy.
Metal. Looks like copper.
Wemple determines that the inner box is made of gold.
It's gold.
Also, it bears the unbroken seal of the pharaoh Amenophis.
I see.
Wemple soon breaks the seal.
The unbroken seals of the pharaoh Amenophis.
Some temple treasure.
But he does so perhaps a little too casually for a truly methodical scientist. Inside is still another box. On it, they read an ancient curse. Death,
death.
Eternal punishment
eternal
for anyone
punishment.
Who opens this casket.
For
note the composition as two figures frame the hieroglyphs. Then, as attention is drawn
casket.
To the inscription, the camera
the
moves closer.
Amun-Ra, the king of the gods.
Wemple and Miller are impressed.
Heavens, what a terrible
Miller
curse.
Urges caution.
Well, let's see what's inside.
Wait! You have read the curse.
But although Wemple accepts his colleague's mastery of the occult sciences, he, like Norton, wants to examine the contents.
Then why did you send for me?
Norton, meanwhile, eagerly dismisses the curse.
Because I saw this find was unique and I wanted your opinion on it.
It is providential that you didn't.
Oh, come, Dr. Miller. Surely a few thousand years in the earth would take the mumbo-jumbo off any old curse.
Oh, I cannot speak before a boy.
Miller, impatient with the young man, takes Wemple out under the stars of Egypt. This is, of course, the author's device to leave Norton alone, but it is one that draws out Miller's personality and also evokes a bit of Egyptian atmosphere.
Open it later. You needn't think you can persuade me not to examine the most wonderful find of my whole experience out here.
The two settings are now intercut, with the older man establishing that the box might contain the Scroll of Thoth and explaining its powers. It is an adroit strategy for Balderston and Freund to alternate between this exposition, which is passive, and Norton's actions, which move the story forward and are among the most gripping in the film. Notice this very compact composition, which includes Norton and the lamp, with a portion of the box tempting him on our left. As Norton looks closer, the camera pulls back. In the next shot, the camera's gliding movement to the other side of the table gives the box central importance visually, but not in an arbitrary fashion, for the camera moves in synchronization with Norton's movement of the lamp. Freund uses a fairly large number of different shots, 10, in this short section which lasts slightly longer than 2 minutes. He also avoids the use of background music, with silence heightening the scene's ominous, oppressive mood. To dramatize the moment of removing the scroll, Freund cuts to empty space and has Norton's head move into view in close-up. Then he pans down to Norton's hands. In a nice bit of staging, Norton pauses to wipe his hands. The tension has made him sweat. He doesn't want to damage the papyrus when he touches it. The action starts to feel ceremonial. Now Freund is about to cut to a new shot, in which the camera is placed in a lower position, so that as Norton unrolls the scroll, it ends up being quite large in the frame. Outside, Mueller puts the events we have just seen and are about to see in context when he urges Wemple to put the box back, reminding him and us about the curse.
I go on with my work for the museum. Come back with me, and we'll examine this great find together.
I cannot condone an act of sacrilege with my presence.
Next, Freund uses film's ability to let viewers know things a character does not. His camera becomes independent. It knows where to look, but we have no way of warning Norton. Then Freund cuts to a close-up of the mummy. We see its eyes open slightly. Then he tilts down to the arms as they slowly unfold. Freund cuts back to Norton, still oblivious of what is happening behind him. Freund tilts down to the scroll, and after a few seconds, a hand enters. The slow lead-up that emphasized camera movement is climaxed now with four sudden cuts keyed to Norton's shock. Again, Freund has to move into a shot for emphasis. While Norton laughs, the camera moves to the doorway, then to the case, and down to the box. These details summarize the action, not through crisp editing, but gradually through camera movements that create anticipation and dreadful inevitability, feelings heightened by the off-screen mad laughter. This sequence does not use dialogue to legitimize what we have seen. It is a tour de force use of images and sound to depict events, to create atmosphere, and to evoke horror, all through implication. This involves viewers by requiring attentiveness and imaginative collaboration. The result is both understated and intense. The final image sums up the situation, placing a dusty handprint next to Norton's transcription of the scroll. This scene has the rather undramatic task of introducing new characters and summarizing the past 10 years. We learn that Frank is Wemple's son, that this expedition has had little success, that 10 years earlier Wemple found too much and refused to return, and that Norton went mad and eventually died. All of this information is efficiently conveyed in about 90 seconds. The filmmakers liven up this rather passive conversation in three ways. They begin by having Frank notice and mention the approach of a visitor, which reassures viewers that something will probably happen soon. The slatted shadows that fall on the two men add texture to the image.
Money wasted, hole after hole dug in this blasted desert. A few beads, a few broken pots. A man needs more than hard work for this game. He needs flair. He needs luck. Like your father.
Oh, in the days when he used to come out here, there wasn't so much competition.
And the action of Frank taking out a cigarette and Professor Pearson offering a match gives us something to watch while the dialogue does its duty.
Queer story that young Oxford chap he had with him going mad. You know what I think it was?
No. What?
I think he went crazy. Bored beyond human endurance, messing around in this sand and these rocks.
He was laughing when your father found him. He died laughing. In a straitjacket. Your father never explained. But when the best excavator England has turned...
Boris Karloff's real entrance in the film occurs now, almost 14 minutes after its start. When Karloff opens the door, notice how quickly and unobtrusively he brings his left arm back to his side, so that after the door swings open, he seems not to have moved at all, as if the door opened by itself. In a close-up, his eyes shift sharply to his left, while his head does not change position. These two details of Karloff's performance help establish the character's controlled, deliberate nature at the very moment of his entrance. Although never stated, it is clear that this man, who calls himself Ardaf Bey, is Imhotep after removing his mummy wrappings. He is now a living person, an independent being with thoughts and will and feeling. Very different from the shambling automaton seen in most later mummy films. Karloff is probably best known for his performance as the Frankenstein monster. However, that dangerous but innocent brute does not represent the actor at his most typical or display all his strengths. The first real showcase for Karloff was The Mask of Fu Manchu, made just before this film in 1932. In it, he played an articulate, sardonic, flamboyant sadist. However, that film's production was too chaotic to result in a truly satisfying work. Indeed, after enduring the extensive rewriting of scenes during the production of The Mask of Fu Manchu, the actor must have found the mummy's carefully pre-planned screenplay a thorough relief. Thus, it was The Mummy which first gave Karloff's physical and vocal talents an ideal setting. Earlier, in his coming-to-life scene, Karloff had been heavily made up. Indeed, he reportedly spent 8 hours being made up and wrapped up for this scene. Given that fact, the filmmakers reveal an amazing degree of restraint and considerable dramatic wisdom by not showing his full figure in motion. Instead, he was just a face and arms and a hand. Now the camera lingers on him in unwrapped form as the actor fully captures what the script describes as slow dignity and uncanny force and power. Karloff's gaunt features, his angular form, and his lisping articulation tend to make such an immediately powerful impression that no matter what he does or says, he runs the risk of overemphasis. Because of this larger-than-life aura, he tends to be most convincing when playing an understated, restrained character. On those occasions, his extraordinary appearance and voice suggest that behind the restraint lie a bitter intelligence and unrelenting will, which could, at any moment, break free with overwhelming power. Imhotep is a menace, a single-minded obsessive who has the power to implement his obsession. He also is a sympathetic figure who once dared the god's wrath in an attempt to return his lover to life, and who now, 3,700 years later, finds himself with a second chance. His threat is strongly felt, as is his suffering and his enduring passion.
And it's unbroken. No one has entered this door since the priests of the royal necropolis sealed it.
3,700 years ago.
After an efficient transition, we enter the Egyptian Museum in Cairo and the room containing items from Ankhsenamun's tomb. Here we see for the first time Freund's camera prowl past display cases and among the artifacts until it reaches Imhotep. Gazes intently at Ankhsenamun's mummy. The deep tones of a bassoon give the image a mournful and ominous mood. From a shot of Ankhsenamun's face on her mummy case, there is a rapid pan across the city, which stops on the face of Helen Grosvenor, connecting her with Ankhsenamun and with Imhotep, well before any of the characters are aware of a link. Such an abstract affinity across space, and in a sense across time, echoes a quality of romanticism in general, and of German expressionist films in particular. Technically, this device has a specific precedent in the 1931 Warner Brothers film Svengali, in which the camera travels across a city to connect Svengali with the woman he controls. Dr. Mueller's conversation with Helen gives us a little information about her. At one point, he calls her my most interesting patient, a line that is particularly intriguing because it is left unexplained.
I am grateful, my most interesting patient.
This scene's rather natural exposition is followed by the epitome of blatant exposition as two unknown men we will never see again discuss Helen for our benefit.
Always spend his winters here. Authority on Egyptian occult.
Yes, but the girl,
Helen Grover. Her father's governor of the Sudan, English, of course. Her mother, Egyptian. Some old family with a tree a mile long. She's staying here with Dr. and Mrs. Miller.
The script now continues developing its two parallel plot threads. After Wemple says that the museum is closing, the rather ordinary response, I did not notice the time, gains an interesting irony when spoken by Imhotep.
The bell has rung. I did not notice the time.
To whom time has a very special meaning.
I am addressing Sir Joseph Wemple.
When Wemple offers his hand, Imhotep glances down and ignores it.
Indeed.
It is typical of Freund's natural, understated staging that the moment receives no emphasis. Soon after, as Wemple reaches to guide Imhotep's elbow, his visitor explains, I dislike to be touched, an Eastern prejudice.
I dislike to be touched, an Eastern prejudice.
Imhotep appreciates the irony of this reversal of the usual attitude. In this scene, note the subtle difference between the straightforward lighting and the long shot, and in the separate shot of Frank, and the more shadowy image of Imhotep.
But now I must
a key to Karloff's performance is the fact that the character's fragility makes him avoid physical activity or even contact. Holding his body erect and still, with his arms at his sides, he is a quietly forceful center of attention. By doing nothing, he appears completely in control of himself and of the situation. At the same time, Karloff's vocal tone gives his dialogue a haunted resonance, to which he adds an edge of ironic politeness, blending dignity with quiet frustration and brooding menace. Karl Freund's camera again tracks through the museum, this time to discover Imhotep kneeling with the scroll of Thoth and a lamp, as he attempts to bring life back to Ankh-Zanamun's body. Earlier, the camera had moved across Cairo to link Helen with Ankh-Zanamun and Imhotep. Now, editing develops that link by revealing the impact his incantations and the repeated name Ankh-Zanamun have on Helen, an impact of which Imhotep is unaware. 11 cuts establish the long-distance power of Imhotep and the scroll. Notice that Freund took the extra trouble to film several quite different views of Imhotep, rather than return each time to the same camera and lighting setup. And the lighting produces some marvelously dramatic and mysterious shadows on his face. Yet those shadows have a natural source, the lamp on the floor below him. The stately rhythm of this intercutting is reminiscent of some German films of the 1920s, notably F.W. Murnau's 1922 version of Dracula, entitled Nosferatu, in which similar editing evokes the fact that the heroine senses the vampire's approach and is drawn to watch for his ship's arrival. In both works, film technique evokes a romantic attraction that is inseparable from a fatalistic sense of doom. Freund did not work on Nosferatu, but he did photograph many of Murnau's other films, and he was a key figure in the German film industry at that time. When Helen arrives at the museum, and trying to get in, collapses at the door, Frank is on his way out. So their paths now cross in a reasonably natural fashion, which brings the separate plot strands together.
I must.
Closed for the night. Everybody's gone home.
I must get in.
Cut, but probably shot, was a short scene in which Wemple pays Helen's taxi driver, and one in which they decide not to take her directly to a hospital. Also, in the script, the death of the museum guard comes next, before the scene with Helen, which now follows. In this scene, Helen repeats Imhotep's name, which reveals her connection, even though Wemple and Frank do not yet understand its implications. Wemple recognizes that she is speaking the language of ancient Egypt, but one might wonder, if it has not been heard for 2,000 years, how he knows what it sounds like, and even how to speak it himself.
Not heard on this earth for 2,000 years. And the name of a man unspoken since before the siege of Troy.
When a museum guard investigates, the camera follows his flashlight beam as it searches the room. This is a clear link between the mummy and Freund's work in Germany, where 8 years earlier he collaborated with F.W. Murnau on Der Letzte Mann, known in English as The Last Laugh. In that film, the camera similarly follows a watchman's light beam as it moves along a hotel corridor. In both cases, light itself becomes a dramatic element. The plot's alternation between Imhotep and Helen continues as Dr. Miller visits her. His arrival is filmed simply, but it does establish the presence of a new character, the Nubian servant, played by Noble Johnson, who had already appeared in Universal's Murders in the Rue Morgue and would soon be seen in RKO's King Kong. Zita Johann's small stature and round face, her large eyes and haunting voice, and a quality of exotic vulnerability set her apart from the usual ingenue, making her immediately recognizable even if one has seen her only in this role. Author John Balderston initially suggested testing Katharine Hepburn for the part of Helen. Miss Johann was born in 1904 in an area of Hungary that is now part of Romania, and she came to the United States with her family at the age of 7. Her Broadway career began in 1924, and her first screen appearance was in director D.W. Griffith's final film, The Struggle, in 1931. Then, for Warner Brothers, she played opposite Edward G. Robinson in Tiger Shark. The Mummy was her third film. She made a few others, but, dissatisfied with Hollywood, she returned to the New York stage. Her husband, while she was making this film, was John Houseman, who soon would collaborate with Orson Welles in the theater and on radio. Miss Johann died in 1993.
Oh, outside the museum.
David Manners may lack unusual characteristics, but he mixed a handsome appearance with a pleasant and responsible manner, which was not all that common in young leading men of the early 1930s. A Canadian, he was born in 1901. His first screen appearance was in James Whale's film Journey's End in 1930. Before making The Mummy, he had appeared with George Arliss in The Millionaire, with Katharine Hepburn and John Barrymore in A Bill of Divorcement, in Frank Capra's The Miracle Woman, and in the Lost Generation drama The Last Flight. Despite his success, Manners lost interest in films and left the profession around 1936. He died at the age of 97 in 1998.
So you did that?
Yes. The 14 steps down and the unbroken seals were thrilling. But when we came to handle all her clothes and her jewels and her toilet things...
Frank reveals to Helen that handling Anxinamen's possessions led him to feel as if he knew her. And he admits that when he saw her face, he sort of fell in love with her. Helen jokingly asks if he has to open graves to find girls to fall in love with. But the issue is more subtly emotional than just necrophilia or love of the dead. Frank feels attracted to a woman from the past, who therefore is unattainable. He is drawn into an emotion doomed to frustration, a desire impossible to satisfy.
Now I know.
This creates a parallel with Imhotep, who was and is passionately committed to the unattainable. First a Vestal virgin, then a dead woman, now a woman dead for thousands of years. Frank has just noticed Helen's resemblance to Anxinamen, so he can now transfer his infatuation to her. Before long, Imhotep will make the same discovery.
Just at closing time. Hello? What? Eleanor? Two treats, Effendi. Come. A museum guard found dead in the room of the princess.
The guard had been killed off-screen, a typically discreet and understated approach, and one that fits the situation, for it protects Imhotep's aura of fragility by not showing him perform an energetic physical act. However, it leads to a logical problem, because there is no clear reason why Imhotep left the scroll behind. Balderston's shooting script accounted for this by having Imhotep try to remove the scroll from the dead guard's hand and be interrupted by a second guard, who sets off alarm bells, turns on the lights, and pulls out his gun. This prompts Imhotep to rise and cat-like slink away. It is not clear why the film leaves this out. After the scene with the police and the dead guard, the script has Frank ask Helen why Mueller calls her his patient, but she avoids a direct answer. Then Imhotep, at his pool, watches Mueller and Wemple return home with the scroll, which explains why Imhotep arrives at the house a short time later.
Hadn't you better not commit your...
Arthur Byron, who plays Wemple, entered films around 1932 when he was 60 years old, and after a Broadway stage career that included the role of the warden in 1929's The Criminal Code, the film version of which included Karloff in the cast. In January 1932, he acted in The Devil Passes with Ernest Thesiger, just before that actor appeared with Karloff in Universal's The Old Dark House. Arthur Byron died in 1943. The role of Dr. Mueller was practically written for Edward Van Sloan, a Broadway veteran who had played Dr. Van Helsing in the stage and film versions of Dracula. He also played Dr. Waldman in the film Frankenstein. For variety, he portrayed a sadist in the 1932 film Behind the Mask. The actor who played Norton in The Mummy's opening sequence was Bramwell Fletcher, an Englishman who was born in 1904. He made his stage debut at the age of 13, and his film debut the following year. Prior to The Mummy, he acted in Svengali with John Barrymore, The Millionaire with George Arliss and David Manners, and A Bill of Divorcement, in which he rejoined Barrymore and Manners. His first wife, of four, was Helen Chandler, who played Mina in Dracula. Dissatisfied with Hollywood, he returned to the New York stage. In the 1960s, he wrote and then toured in a one-man show about George Bernard Shaw. He died in 1988.
Oh, he stole it. Look here, Dr. Miller. What's the matter with Miss Grosvenor?
You still think that that mummy was stolen, Sir Joseph?
Yes, I don't know.
Now Imhotep enters, seeking the scroll. Earlier, when Mueller arrived, Freund used only a single long shot. Here he lingers on separate close shots of the Nubian and Imhotep. In a close-up, a subtle change in the lighting causes Imhotep's eyes to brighten with intensity and mystic power as he places the Nubian under his control. Here, at virtually the film's midpoint, Imhotep and Helen will meet for the first time and realize their connection. Before this point, all Imhotep wanted was to revive the mummy of his lover, for which he needs the scroll. Now, however, the situation becomes much more complicated. The relationship between Imhotep and Helen seems so appropriate, even inevitable, that it comes almost as a shock to realize how different it is from the original concept for the film. The project originated with Nina Wilcox Putnam, a popular author of stories for magazines like the Saturday Evening Post. Independent in her life and assertive in her opinions, she was an early advocate of women's rights. In her fiction, she usually dealt with women's domestic and professional lives in a humorous style. So it is surprising that in 1932, she supplied Universal with stories for a Tom Mix Western and a Boris Karloff horror film. By the first week of February 1932, Putnam completed Cagliostro, a 9-page story. Then she and Richard Scheer, the head of Universal's scenario department, developed it into a more extended form, dated February 19th. In Putnam's plot, a Dr. Astro, a spiritualist in modern San Francisco, is actually an Egyptian priest who has stayed alive for 4,000 years by injecting himself with nitrates. At one point in his history, prior to the French Revolution, he was the notorious Cagliostro, whose seances were popular in Parisian high society. He observes people with a television surveillance system, and his death ray homes in on medallions which he gives to intended victims. With these devices, he commits robberies and eliminates enemies. He is served by a mute Nubian. The heroine, Helen Dorrington, works selling tickets at a movie theater. Helen's boyfriend, Dr. Jack Foster, was physician to millionaire H.G. Wemple, who is killed by the death ray. Wemple, deeply religious, resented as sacrilege the archaeological achievements of his brother, Professor Wemple, and therefore left his money in trust to Jack. This leads the police to suspect Jack of Wemple's murder. Astro poses as the blind, long-lost uncle of Helen, who happens to resemble his ancient mistress. He rents Wemple's mansion and gets Helen to work for him, but she senses something uncanny in the house and notices that his hands leave dusty imprints. Meanwhile, Jack seeks to expose Astro, the spiritualist, as a charlatan. Both Jack and Professor Wemple investigate a series of sensational robberies. Later, Helen tries to leave, but is imprisoned in the cellar by the Nubian. While Astro is busy trying to steal a supply of nitrates from a safe deposit vault, the professor invades the house and takes Astro's nitrate supply. Astro's theft is not completed, but the professor is thrown in the cellar with Helen. They are rescued by Jack when Astro crumbles to dust without his nitrates. In Nina Wilcox Putnam's early version of the story, Astro was betrayed by his lover in ancient Egypt, so he spends the centuries avenging himself by destroying women who resemble her. In other words, The Mummy originated as not a love story, but a hate story.
Yes, they told me I went there and tried to get in.
One finds very little resemblance to The Mummy in this tangle of arbitrary events and contrived relationships. To impose dramatic coherence on Cagliostro, Universal sought out John L. Balderston, a former magazine editor and journalist who had co-written the popular 1926 play Berkeley Square. He also adapted Hamilton Dean's play Dracula for American audiences and did the same for Peggy Webling's play version of Frankenstein. Both of these works provided Universal with the basis for successful films in 1931. But Balderston had not written a film script before.
We must see each other again.
He arrived in Hollywood near the end of March 1932 and set to work transforming the muddle that was Cagliostro. He retained some elements of Putnam's plots, which he mixed with inspirations drawn from other sources and his own imagination. Balderston's first incomplete screenplay, dated June 30, was followed by a complete version on July 13, then five more during August and September. The last, dated September 12, was published by Magic Image Film Books in 1989. As Balderston shaped these elements, he drew on his own adaptation of Dracula to flesh out the relationships and evolve the plot. At one point, he considered requiring that the mummy, like a vampire, return regularly to his coffin-like mummy case, and he argued that the film should be titled Undead. Ultimately, the mummy's relationship to Dracula became less obvious, but it exists. Both films feature an undead being who, in a sense, seduces the heroine, threatening her with death while offering a kind of eternal life, thereby endangering both her life and her soul. In both cases, the creature is politely ironic and exerts hypnotic power. Combating him are a young man who loves the heroine and an older expert in the occult, played in both films by, respectively, David Manners and Edward Van Sloan. Each film includes a pivotal scene in which the expert tests his suspicions by confronting his opponent with an object, a mirror in Dracula and a photograph in The Mummy, which prompts the creature to drop his pose of civility. And in each case, a talisman offers protection from the creature's power. A figure of Isis serves this function in The Mummy, a crucifix in Dracula.
You also know that you must return that scroll to me or die. Now tell that weak fool to get that scroll wherever it is and hand it to his Nubian servant.
The Nubian?
The ancient blood. So you have made him your slave. If I could get my hands on you, I'd break your dried flesh to pieces. But your power is too strong.
Between this scene and the next, the shooting script included a scene of Frank and Helen in his car, talking outside her hotel. In it, she states that she does not want to see Imhotep again, despite what she had said in his presence earlier.
Burn the scroll, man. Burn it. It was through you this horror came into existence.
It's true. It's true.
In the opening shot of Imhotep at his pool, we see a white cat, which the screenplay states is Imhotep's familiar, which is linked with the cat goddess Bast. The script took pains to establish this cat's presence whenever Imhotep is in this setting. At one point, it states that the cat seems to be taking part in the ceremony, and during the murder of Wemple, it describes a close-up of the cat with its fur erect, paws extended with claws out, gazing into the pool, spitting. Most of this was not included in the film. In developing a script for what became The Mummy, Balderston apparently elaborated on the references to Astro being an ancient Egyptian and Professor Wemple being an archaeologist, drawing for inspiration on the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb. He himself had, as a journalist, covered that discovery in the 1920s, and his final screenplay makes frequent, knowledgeable references to Egyptian artifacts and to such specific details as the Semiramis Hotel, Queen Hatshepsut's temple, the village of Kerna, and Cairo's street names. Even the names Imhotep and Ankhsenamun are authentic, although they were not who the film says they were. Balderston moved the setting of the film's story from San Francisco to New York, and finally to Cairo. But Egypt and Tutankhamun's tomb did more than supply an exotic setting. They led Balderston to provide the mummy with a curse which promises death to anyone who opens the box containing the scroll. For all its dramatic impact, this curse is ultimately more misleading than meaningful, for by opening the box, the archaeologists do Imhotep a service by returning him to life. Once revived, he does not seek to avenge their sacrilege. In fact, they are useful to him, for they unearth the mummy of Ankhsenamun. Whenever Imhotep attacks someone, such as Wemple, it is not out of revenge or to protect a tomb, but because that person stands in the way of his goal by trying to destroy the scroll or lure Helen from him. This goal is essential to the film's plot and its sensitive characterizations, and it completely reverses the main character's negative motivation in Putnam's original story.
He's an old servant.
Imhotep's romantic situation also evokes that of Balderston's play Berkeley Square, in which a contemporary Englishman finds himself in 18th century London, where he falls in love with a woman from the past. Balderston combined this concept of love across time with the fact that Ankhsenamun's soul has been reincarnated in Helen, which creates in her a struggle between her ancient self and her modern one.
Because I think she's the most wonderful. Oh, but this is terrible at a time like this.
Frank, I'm afraid. Will you go with me to her now?
Yes.
Then telephone her first, not to leave the hotel.
After Frank telephones Helen and she agrees not to leave her hotel, There was a substantial amount of footage eliminated before the film's release. Out of about 13 pages of the script, all that remains is a short scene, 1.5 pages long, in which Mueller examines the ashes and realizes they are just newspaper.
Goodbye.
The cut footage shows Imhotep at the pool, watching Helen at her hotel. As he concentrates, Helen's dog whines. She leaves. Frank and Mueller, in Frank's car, talk about Helen. Meanwhile, Helen arrives at the museum and examines the display of Ankh-Senamun's personal items. The jewelry found on her mummy, pots of ointment, jars of perfume, and a circular bronze mirror with its handle in the form of Isis. At one point, Helen takes out her own lipstick and powder puff and adjusts her makeup using her reflection in the bronze mirror, an object which the script intends to reuse later. The scroll is papyrus. Then Imhotep joins Helen and discusses the objects with her. His attempt to awaken a memory of her prior life succeeds, as she comments, "I feel as though I have seen those things before." During this section, the power of the Isis amulet is established when Imhotep turns away in fear from one that is on display. Meanwhile, Frank and Mueller arrive at Helen's door, they hear her dog whining, and find she is gone. They decide to look for her at the museum, and at this point, Mueller finds that the ashes are of newsprint. Imhotep tells Helen, "You will come to me tomorrow," then leaves. Frank and Mueller enter and speak with Helen. The discarded scenes would have ended with Imhotep's dusty handprint, reminding viewers of the final shot of the opening sequence. Helen's visit to Imhotep's house and her scene by his pool were originally planned to occur the next day, but now they immediately follow Frank's telephone call, which compresses events effectively. One certainly would like to see the missing scene between Imhotep and Helen in the museum, but its elimination was probably wise. Its dialogue seems unnecessarily blunt about Helen's feeling of kinship to Ankh-Senamun, and her encounter with Imhotep there would certainly have diluted the impact of the scene in which she visits him at his house.
Your dog is frightened.
The situation involving Helen's dog at Imhotep's house is quite a bit clearer in the shooting script, which describes a close-up of this cat standing with outraged dignity as it looks at the dog, followed by a close-up of the dog afraid of the cat. Then, after the dog is taken from the room, the camera was to pan to the cat, now sitting with dignity. Helen reaches over to pet the cat, but it turns its head away from her.
What a strange incense.
Is it not familiar to you?
No.
Our forefathers used it. Yours and mine. You will not remember what I show you now, and yet I shall awaken memories of love and crime and death.
As shot, this scene had Imhotep show only Ankh-Senamun's death, her burial, and his interrupted attempt to revive her, but no more than that. Later, during the final sequence at the museum, Imhotep would use a mirror to reflect images that guide Helen back through her several prior lives. In the most recent of these lives, she rejects a young gallant in 18th century France. Moving progressively further back in time, she bids farewell to 13th century crusaders. She commits suicide in an 8th century Saxon stockade, and she becomes a Christian martyr in ancient Rome. Finally, she sees herself embrace Imhotep in the sanctuary of Isis, and only after reaching this point does Imhotep finally reveal the events surrounding his own burial alive. The scenes depicting Helen's other lives and identities were filmed, and several still photos exist which illustrate them. However, this material truly is extraneous to the main issue, which is Imhotep's need to reclaim Ankh-Senamun, so the footage was dropped, and appropriately so. However, Henry Victor, who played a Saxon warrior in the cut footage, remains in the cast list included at the end of the film. An odd oversight. And publicity materials listed both him and Arnold Gray, who appeared as a knight in the cut flashbacks. When these scenes were cut out, the footage depicting Imhotep's fate in ancient Egypt was moved to this earlier scene by the pool, so that the flashback tale is now told all at once. This renders the film more compact. It makes Imhotep's statement about his suffering for her more comprehensible, but it also obscures the meaning of his line, "But the rest you may not know, not until you are about to pass through the great night of terror and triumph." These changes certainly streamline the climax, making it a tight and dramatic culmination of known factors, with no new plot elements added at the last minute to distract. The accurate detail and atmospheric quality of the mummy's Egyptian settings are the contribution of designer Vili Pogani. Not a regular Hollywood employee, he also engaged in various other artistic pursuits, including theatrical set design, painting pictures, and illustrating children's stories such as Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. In 1931, he had worked on three films produced by Samuel Goldwyn, including The Unholy Garden, which had a desert setting. But he may have been selected for The Mummy because of a 1926 Broadway play he had designed called The Jeweled Tree. That production took place in ancient Egypt, and Pogani's sets were singled out for praise. After The Mummy, he worked on four musicals released in 1934, notably Kid Millions, for which he designed the lavish Technicolor ice cream fantasy sequence.
Lord, and buried with me, that no such sacrilege might disgrace Egypt again.
In addition to physical and emotional suffering, Karloff's restraint also suggests Imhotep's unwavering love for Anxinamen, an emotion that so transcends mere feeling that it has taken possession of him and become his entire nature. This was one aspect of the plot that appealed to John Balderston. As early as April 4th, 1932, when he had just started to work on the project, he wrote in a studio memo, quote, "Even the mummy is not incapable of some humanization. He can be really affecting when he tells the girl what a lonely time he has had looking for her through all the countries, all times, all civilizations, for 4,000 years. There is a love story for you." Unquote. And he added that the character will get another moment of sympathy, quote, "when the audience sees his despair," unquote, during the flashback of Anxinamen's burial. Imhotep's tragedy is not his suffering at being buried alive, but his isolation, which is made especially poignant by the fact that the woman for whom he sacrificed everything has been reincarnated as someone to whom he is a stranger. As Imhotep tells Helen of his austere passion, his ancient torment, Karloff speaks these lines in an almost flat tone that nonetheless captures the emotion in the words, as well as the rhythmic musicality of the syllables and of the alliteration. What a pleasure it must have been to speak such well-phrased dialogue, especially when it is so attuned to the way his voice echoes the dry precision of the desert sands and time itself.
Anxinamen, my love has lasted longer than the temples of our gods. No man ever suffered as I did for you, but the rest you may not know,
Not until you are about to pass through the great night of terror and triumph. Until you are ready to face moments of horror for an eternity of love. Until I send back your spirit that has wandered through so many forms and so many ages. But before then, Bast must again send forth death. Death to that boy for whom love is creeping into your heart. Love that would keep you from myself. Love that might bring sickness and even death to you. Awake.
Have I been asleep? I had strange dreams. Dreams of ancient Egypt, I think. There was someone like you in them.
My pool is sometimes troubled. One sees strange fantasies in the water, but they pass like dreams.
When off-screen sounds indicate that Helen's dog has been killed, probably by the cat, the situation in the release print is less clear than it might have been, because so many of the script's references to the cat have been omitted. In 1931, Dracula had established a precedent in American horror films by taking a supernatural subject seriously. Another of John Balderston's positive contributions to The Mummy is the fact that he removed from Putnam's original story the pseudo-scientific explanations for events. The nitrates, which supposedly kept Cagliostro alive for centuries, have been replaced with the Scroll of Thoth, the reading of which can raise the dead. Thus, the screenplay totally accepts the efficacy of ancient Egypt's religious beliefs, and most audiences are willing to go along with that premise. In the process, Astro's television surveillance system becomes Imhotep's pool, in which he observes activities elsewhere.
I don't remember.
And Astro's death ray has become the combination of muttered spells and mental power that Imhotep uses to kill Wemple and later to attack Frank. All of these mystical elements somehow come across in the film as much more convincing than the far-fetched pseudo-scientific aspects would have.
Try to remember, Helen.
I don't want to remember. Besides, I don't see that it's any affair of yours.
A related influence on the final screenplay derives at least partly from the fact that after Balderston began work on this film, he received a second assignment from Universal to adapt H. Rider Haggard's 1887 fantasy novel, She. In working on both projects simultaneously, he submitted a 33-page treatment of She on July 17, just 4 days after completing his second Mummy script. A second treatment of She followed on August 2nd. After that, he concentrated on The Mummy and did not complete a screenplay of She until October 17, while The Mummy was in production. Universal probably didn't produce She because of its budget, but the studio may also have realized that The Mummy included enough elements from She that a resemblance between the two might have been evident. Finally, on May 31st, 1934, Universal sold its rights to She to RKO and transferred to that studio Balderston's treatments and screenplay. Marion C. Cooper's 1935 RKO film of She does not credit Balderston, but some of its dialogue echoes The Mummy's and may derive from his work. Both She and The Mummy juxtapose an ancient romance with a modern one. In both, one person survives from the past, and the other is reincarnated in a new body. In She, Kallikrates, a priest of Isis, committed sacrilege by loving the princess Amenartis. After the two flee from Egypt, they cross paths with Aisha, who falls in love with the priest. But because he loves another, she kills him in jealous anger. Because Aisha gains immortality by bathing in a magical flame, she lives on, awaiting the return of her beloved. And return he does, 2,000 years later, in the form of Leo Vinci, the descendant and, in a sense, the reincarnation of Kallikrates. By blending Amenartis and Aisha into a single character and reversing the lovers' sexes, The Mummy turns this situation into the forbidden love of Imhotep and Princess Anxinamen, a priestess of Isis, who broke her vows as a Vestal virgin.
You understand?
Before Aisha can be reunited with her reincarnated love, he must die and be reborn, thus becoming immortal like her. As a first step, she destroys the original lover's preserved body. Similarly, Imhotep must kill Helen, mummify her body, and then use the scroll to revive it to eternal life. First, he burns Ankhsenamun's mummy.
Then I know I can make you love me.
In another link between the mummy and she, both Imhotep and Aisha reveal to others images of the past in the surface of a pool of water.
Because I'd rather die than live and lose you.
Aisha and Imhotep share a mixture of malevolence and suffering. Each is, in Haggard's words, quote, a being who, unconstrained by human law, is also absolutely unshackled by a moral sense of right and wrong, unquote. Both are passionately devoted to satisfying the long-denied need to be with their beloveds. In She, a native girl falls in love with Leo, so Aisha kills her rival with the power of her eyes and her will. Both Aisha's method and her casual ruthlessness are transferred to Imhotep, who tries to destroy Frank Wimple for the same reason. In the 1935 film, She, a character based on the native girl, tells Aisha that she has a stronger hold on Leo, quote, because I'm young, and you know love belongs to the young. You were young once like me, but now you're old and it's too late for love forever, unquote. This character sounds very much like Helen Grosvenor, who, speaking as Ankhsenamun in The Mummy's Climax, tells Imhotep, I'm alive, I'm young, I loved you once, but now you belong with the dead. I want to live, even in this strange new world. This material, seemingly derived from She, helps give the mummy the emotional substance and dramatic power that cannot be glimpsed in Cagliostro's plot. The mummy's screenplay was so carefully pre-planned and so faithfully followed that in only one major instance was its structure altered before shooting began. In the original plan, the scene of Imhotep's attack on Frank occurred almost immediately after she returns from visiting Imhotep. Before filming, that scene was rewritten and moved to this spot, just before the film's climax, where it certainly has greater dramatic impact. At the same time, the character of Frau Müller was replaced with that of the nurse who tends Helen. The first version of the scene did not involve Helen leaving her room. After three shots that concisely summarize the museum break-in, we discover Imhotep with Helen, who already wears ancient Egyptian costume and is talking with Imhotep as Ankhsenamun. The shooting script led up to this moment much more gradually. It describes the camera moving with a watchman as he walks outside. Then it moves to the window with its bars bent and on to some shrubbery and trees, from behind which Imhotep and Helen emerge. The Nubian servant, already within, starts to help Helen enter through the window. Inside, Imhotep confronts a guard who collapses from his stare. An antique oil lamp is obtained from a display, and the Nubian hands Helen clothing to put on.
Many times.
A necklace and bracelets are taken from other cases for Helen to wear.
That love is not for
finally, Imhotep takes the bronze mirror, has Helen gaze into it, and through it reflects her stages of reincarnation and the rest of the events which in the release print already were shown in the pool scene. In the release print, we join Helen and Imhotep just after the end of the flashbacks. As she says, no man has ever suffered for woman as you have suffered for me.
Figure of myself. It is my coffin made by my father against my death. What mummy has usurped my eternal resting place?
It is thy dead shell.
A key figure in the success of the mummy must be its director, Karl Freund. However, any attempt to specify Freund's contribution requires some speculation, because the shooting script, credited solely to Balderston, includes detailed descriptions of editing and camera movements. Indeed, though some changes were made on the set and during post-production, all of the major creative decisions are represented in the script. Thus, the director had no major artistic problems to solve while shooting. He merely executed the already refined plans. For example, the script's description of the mummy's return to life includes all of the subtle camera movements and the decision not to show the mummy move through the room. Everything of significance in this scene already existed in the screenplay. However, it is hard to imagine that Balderston, a first-time screenwriter, possessed such a refined cinematic sense that all Freund had to do was follow his instructions. If so, Balderston surely would have been in greater demand. But aside from the 1933 adaptation of his own play, Berkeley Square, he did not receive another screen credit until 3 years after The Mummy, and of his 19 screen credits, all but The Mummy and one other were written in collaboration. It also is hard to imagine that Karl Freund, in his directorial debut, would have deferred so completely to a novice. In Germany during the 1920s, this eminent cinematographer had been a major artistic collaborator on 10 films directed by the renowned F.W. Murnau, as well as on Paul Wegener's The Golem in 1920 and Fritz Lang's Metropolis in 1927. He also had helped write and shoot the 1926 documentary, Berlin, The Symphony of a Great City, and had supervised the direction of a 1926 feature, The Adventures of a Ten-Mark Note. After coming to the United States in 1929, Freund devised the poetic ending of Universal's All Quiet on the Western Front in 1930, and reportedly had substantial influence on Todd Browning's Dracula. Freund was a filmmaker, not a photographic technician.
No.
Could Freund have had input while Balderston was writing The Mummy? On August 29th, 1932, Universal announced Freund's assignment to direct what was then called Imhotep, 1 week before Balderston completed his sixth screenplay, 2 weeks before the shooting script, and about 21 days before shooting began. In addition, Freund had completed photographing Universal's Afraid to Talk earlier in August, so for about 1 month, he was free to help develop the script. Without further evidence, one cannot be certain of the nature or extent of Freund's contributions. However, it is more reasonable to assume that he participated than to assume that he patiently waited for the finished script and then modestly shot it as written. Certainly, Freund did develop a close working relationship with Balderston, for on The Mummy, he instituted a new system for Universal, one in which he, as director, could call the writer to the set to assist in script revision. The Mummy's use of moving camera and the slow pace that results link the film's visual style to Freund's background in the German film industry of the 1920s, which lingered on images to create what is known as Stimmung, a sense of the psychological or emotional atmosphere that hovers in the space around people and objects. To a viewer whose sensibility is confined to the physical and tangible, a German filmmaker's willingness to devote time to creating Stimmung in his images will seem like an intolerably slow pace, for action becomes secondary to the imprecise and the unstated. In addition to such subtle overtones, one may surely credit to Freund the dramatic impact of placing the Nubian and his vat of embalming fluid large in the foreground of one shot, and to have his shadow cast on the wall near Helen as an almost spectral embodiment of her imminent fate.
Now I know his horrible plan. He is going to kill her and make her a living mummy like himself.
Intercutting in the film's climax suggests a traditional last-minute rescue. But in fact, Freund is more interested in helplessness than rescue, as revealed by the contrast between the carefully chosen, intense shots of Imhotep and his preparations, which are much more varied and impressive than the nondescript long shots of Frank and Müller on their way.
You shall rest from night, like the setting sun in the west. But you shall dawn anew in the east as the first rays of Amon-Ra dispel the shadow.
Look! What's that?
Also, the alternation back and forth feels half-hearted, almost a token gesture toward building suspense.
Helen! Helen! Helen!
Oh, I said, holy maiden, I was thy consecrated vessel. I broke my vows. Save me now. Teach me the ancient summons, the holy spells I've forgotten. I call upon thee as of old.
Appropriately, although the heroes do arrive in time, they are unable to save Helen, because Imhotep easily renders them powerless. So Helen, still possessed by the identity of Ankh-Senamun, prays to the goddess Isis for help, using the language of ancient Egypt. The statue's arm moves, the scroll burns, and Imhotep disintegrates. Karl Freund would direct a few more films, generally minor, but his directorial career ended on a very strong note with the outstanding Mad Love, made for MGM in 1935. At its release, The Mummy was met with generally dismissive reviews and only a lukewarm reception at the box office. Nonetheless, it has survived through time and can be seen now as a subtle and austerely passionate story of love and pain and dread, one that makes graceful, even elegant use of the motion picture medium. If any one actor and character and film can embody the exotic yet accessible satisfactions of the classic American horror film, then that actor is Boris Karloff, and that character is Imhotep, and that film is The Mummy. This is Paul Jensen.
Stars will shine tonight, one for the lonely. That star will shine its light each time that someone sighs. Three stars for all to see, one for young lovers, that star was made to be the sparkle in their eyes. And for the third star, only one reason, a star you can wish on to make dreams come true. High in the sky above, three stars are shining. I hope that star of love will shine down on you. Third star, only one reason, a star you can wish on to make dreams come true. High in the sky above, three stars are shining. I hope that star of love shine down on.